You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the July 11th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs. Usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. This coming Monday, President Donald Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin will sit down in a room together in the Finnish capital for their first summit meeting. The fact that they're even holding this meeting seems to trouble Democrats and liberal media even more than Trump's tete-a-tete with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. That led to his canceling of the annual war game staged by U.S. forces and the South Korean military forces close to the partition between the two Koreas, which troubled Republicans as well as Democrats. Now, what will he promise to give away at the hands of the wily Putin, they wonder? Well, it's good for American presidents to meet with adversaries to clarify differences and resolve disputes, the New York Times editorialized. But when President Trump sits down with President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, kindred spirits, and that's a problem, end quote. That Trump said yesterday that meeting with Putin will be easier than the NATO summit that began today in Brussels and runs to tomorrow probably will give critics of the meeting even more concern. The headline of Monday's New York Times leading the way said that Trump will be, quote, wild card among the allies, and argue that in the Trump era, however, that these meetings have become, quote, anxiety-producing confrontations where the main object is to avoid long-term damage to the military alliance. This time, the stakes are even higher, says the Times report, as the allies seek to project strength and solidarity against Russian threats, end quote. And these threats are never spelled out because they really don't exist anymore than they did in the first Cold War is beside the point. What's interesting is the different responses on the part of Democrats to Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin compared with how positively Democrats of the earlier Cold War generation responded to Richard Nixon's meeting with Mao Zedong in Beijing in 1972. To discuss those differences and their implications, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with veteran foreign correspondent and head of Consortium News, Joe Loria. So stay tuned for that. One issue that the mainstream media keeps harping about when it comes to Putin is Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Not once, I repeat, not once have I heard any one of the government experts on NPR or other mainstream news note that this was not out of the blue, but came in response to the U.S.-backed coup in Kiev, which toppled the legally elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. Yanukovych, like every other Ukrainian head of state before and since, was mired in corruption, and his replacement, Petro Poroshenko, has been no different. For the moment, whether or not one accepts the 97% of the Russian-speaking Crimeans voted to once again become part of Russia, it was evident from a geopolitical standpoint that Russia could not afford to give up control of the Crimean port of Sevastopol, where, in arrangement with the Ukraine government, it kept 25,000 troops stationed. Given the virulent anti-Russian feelings of those who pulled off the 2014 coup, it was likely the new pro-Western government in Kiev would cancel the agreement and pressure the Russians to leave. Putin's action preempted that. At the meeting of the G7 in Ottawa, Trump had reportedly rattled a few cages by defending Russia's retaking of Crimea on the basis that the people there speak Russian. Why they do, the media never explains, so I will in brief. From the middle of the 15th century to 1783, Crimea was part of the Ottoman Empire. In that year, under Catherine the Great, Russia defeated the Ottomans, and under the treaty ending the war, Crimea became part of Russia and later the Soviet Union. That was the way things stood until 1954, when Soviet Premier, the Ukrainian-born Nikita Khrushchev, transferred Crimea from the jurisdiction of the Russian Federation to that of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, where, following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, it would become an autonomous republic with its own parliament within an independent Ukraine. In the aftermath of the coup, the Crimean parliament, following the overwhelming popular vote, elected to join the Russian Federation. Considering that the legitimate government of Ukraine had been overthrown, it can be argued the Crimeans had every right to do that. The U.S. and its Western allies, of course, have refused to accept that decision or even discuss it, and Russia was then subjected to sanctions. You may recall that Putin and his allies in eastern Ukraine, where there had been no reported anti-government protest, charged at the more militant of the opponents to Yanukovych in Maidan Square with the political descendants of an organization that had allied itself with Nazi Germany in World War II. Of course, this was played down by the U.S. media and ignored by the Obama administration and its point person, Victoria Nuland, his Secretary of State for Europe, and Hillary Clinton's former press spokesperson. Twice I have played a short clip for you from Nuland's pre-coup talk to the Ukrainian American Association, in which she said that the U.S. had spent $5 billion, that's billion with a B, to change the regime in Ukraine. And you also heard here twice her secretly recorded phone conversation, no doubt by the Russians, with the U.S. ambassador, in which she decided before the coup who would be the next leader of the Ukrainian, of the next Ukrainian prime minister. But we don't hear much about Ukraine anymore, except small stories about the continuing corruption. Monday's Israeli Daily Haaretz, however, had a story on Ukraine you will not likely hear or read about in any mainstream U.S. media. A group of more than 40 Israeli human rights activists have filed a petition with Israel's High Court of Justice demanding the ending of Israeli arms exports to Ukraine. They argue, according to Haaretz, that Israeli weapons have gone to forces that openly espouse a neo-Nazi ideology, and they cite evidence that the right-wing Azov militia, whose members are part of Ukraine's armed forces and supported by the country's Ministry of Internal Affairs, are using these weapons. An earlier response of theirs to the Israel Defense Ministry received no response. The Azov militia was established in Ukraine following the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. According to the Haaretz article, its members use the Nazi salute and its uniforms carry swastikas and SS insignias. The militia's founder, Andriy Beletsky, currently a member of Ukraine's parliament, formerly headed a neo-Nazi group called Patriot of Ukraine, now defunct. Its members comprise the founding core of Azov. Since the spring of 2015, members of the Azov militia have reportedly been part of the regular security forces in Ukraine, the National Guard. While the militia encourages its members to enlist in the National Guard, it maintains itself as a separate organization. Lawyers for the petitioners in Israel have provided the court with ample evidence of Israel's role in arming Ukraine. Ukrainian soldiers, they say, for example, have been seen carrying Israeli-made Tavor rifles in military practices. And a Ukrainian company has signed a contract to produce the Tavor as well as two other Israeli rifles. Elbit Systems, one of Israel's largest military contractors, is to be part of a group investing in Ukraine's military establishment. 4 years ago, Elbit received a $145 million contract from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to build surveillance towers on the Arizona-Mexico border. In the city of Dnepropetrovsk in eastern Ukraine, the petitioners charge there's a military training school where the instruction is provided by former Israeli army officers and other instructors are trained by Israelis. The website has a photo of shooting practice with a Tavor rifle and notes the school trains units of the National Guard, whose members include Azov militiamen, as I mentioned, whose own website shows them using a Tavor. In May 2017, Ukraine's Prime Minister Vladimir Grossman visited Israel and met with Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman to discuss the arming of Ukraine's military forces. In December of that year, a man claiming to be a former Israeli officer was interviewed by Ukrainian rebels, saying that he had taken part in battles in eastern Ukraine where he was instructing soldiers. All of this, concludes the Haaretz article, is unambiguous proof that Israel is exporting weapons to Ukraine, knowing that they reach right-wing militias, some members of which are avowed neo-Nazis who enjoy the support of the authorities, end quote. In several programs, beginning last December, I have brought you stories from the Israeli media describing U.S. collusion with Israel regarding Iran that have been totally censored by the U.S. media. Here's another one. On July 3rd, the Times of Israel reported that Israel and the U.S. have established a joint task force geared toward exploiting and amplifying internal pressure on the Iranian regime. Whether this is the same or a different task force as the one secretly set up between the country's two intelligence agencies last December, which I reported to you, and never reported elsewhere in the U.S. media, is not clear. The Times of Israel was citing a report in Israel's Channel 10 that Israel's National Security Advisor, Meir Ben-Shabbat, and his American counterpart, John Bolton, had met to plan a strategy for turning up the heat on the government in Tehran. The Islamic Republic has seen multiple mass protests and the reported deaths of several demonstrators in the past week due to a water crisis and worsening economic conditions triggered by the U.S. pullout from the nuclear deal. The report quoted a senior Israeli official as saying the goal of the task force isn't to topple the regime. No one thinks that can be done, he is quoted as saying. Rather, he said, its aim is to exploit internal pressure in Iran in order to force the Ayatollahs, quote, to change their behavior, end quote. Bolton, who in past has called for both bombing Iran as well as regime change, said in May that toppling the government in Iran is not the Trump administration's goal. Seriously, does anyone believe that? Anyway, separately, Hadashah TV News in Israel reported Tuesday that the foreign ministry has sent a document to Israeli diplomatic missions around the world detailing efforts to turn up the heat on Iran. According to the government document, President Trump's exit from the nuclear deal and the American policy to create pressure on Iran correlate with Israel's policy. Well, Ed Schultz, the outspoken TV and radio host, died last Thursday. He was 64, and his outspokenness got him canned from MSNBC, as he explains in the short interview made at his last job as a host on RT America, the TV station subsidized by the Russian government that has a number of U.S. hosts, yet has been forced to register as a foreign agent by the federal government. It's instructive to hear what he has to say about the U.S. media and our political system. Here's Ed Schultz.
There was more oversight and more direction given to me on content at MSNBC than there ever has been here at RT. And I think that it's very sad that that story is not getting out. I think it's many times I was told what to lead with on MSNBC. Many times I was told what I was not going to do, and I've got a story that had I not been involved in it, I would have never believed it. And Phil Griffin, who I consider a friend to this day, was a watchdog, far more than anything I'm exposed to here at RT America.
Did he tell you what to say? Did he tell you an angle to take?
Often. In fact, when Bernie Sanders was announcing that he was going to be a candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party in Burlington, Vermont, I was the only cable host between Fox, MSNBC, and CNN that was there live to cover it. Now, there were live cameras there, but we had coordinated with the Sanders campaign that at 5 o'clock he was going to make his announcement, and we were going to cover this on the Ed Show. I go to Bernie Sanders' house that afternoon, an interview in the backyard, about a 15-minute interview. The grandkids are running around. It's a big day for the Sanders family. He's going to announce that he's running for president. We're going to carry it live later on in the day, and we're going to run this one-on-one tape with Bernie. 3,000 people are there on Lake Champlain. It's 5 minutes to air, and I get a phone call from Phil Griffin. You're not covering this. I said, Phil, Bernie Sanders is announcing he's running for president. He's going to be a president. I don't care. You're not covering this. And it got rather contentious. Now you're asking me for opinion. I'm giving you fact right now about what happened. And other people who were there with me will attest to the fact and back me up that this is what happened. We were told that we had to cover something that was totally meaningless. In another press conference in Baltimore, which was already had been in the news for a few days. We're covering Bernie Sanders live. We're coordinated with his campaign. And I'm told 5 minutes before, you're not covering Bernie Sanders. Now, let me give you the opinion. I think the Clintons were connected to Andy Lack, connected at the hip. I think that they didn't want anybody in their prime time or anywhere in their lineup supporting Bernie Sanders. I think that they were in the tank for Hillary Clinton, and I think it was managed, and 45 days later I was out at MSNBC. And when you see how the campaign unfolded, Donna Brazile feeding Hillary Clinton questions at the campaign, the DNC undercutting Bernie Sanders, the superdelegates that were organized by Hillary Clinton. I mean, in my state of Minnesota, where I'm a resident and pay taxes, Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar were superdelegates, and despite the fact that Bernie Sanders won Minnesota, they supported Clinton. It was the fix was in. The fix was in with the mainstream media. The fix was in with managing the news and shutting down Bernie Sanders. And it wasn't until he started matching the Clintons and raising money that he became, well, we gotta cover this guy. But from the start, the Clintons didn't want any competition. They didn't want Bernie Sanders around. They didn't want the Keystone XL pipeline. They didn't want to push her on that issue. They didn't want to push her on free education for all. And they certainly didn't want to push her on the TPP and also universal health care. Those were four main issues that Bernie Sanders, had he not been at the campaign, Hillary Clinton would have never had to address. And so I think the fix was in early on to deep six Bernie. To this day, it kind of pisses me off. Because, they talk about collusion. There's nothing more than collusion than this.
And that was Ed Schultz, died last Thursday, 64, a rare voice in American media, taken off by MSNBC and ended up being on RT. We'll miss him. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature the first of what will be several presentations recorded at the conference titled Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, held on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. The conference was sponsored by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine and the Trans-Arab Research Institute. The quality of the presentations was incredible, and we want to bring you as many of them as possible over the next several weeks on This Week in Palestine. We begin this morning with the keynote address delivered by Youssef Munayer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights.
Thank you so much for that very kind introduction, Elaine. Let me begin by saying that all of us can be inspired by what is a truly dynamic young generation of activists and scholars working on Palestine. But this is a generation that follows in the footsteps of those who came before us, like Elaine, like Nasir Haruri, and like so many more who have given us the foundation from which to take our struggle forward. It's a pleasure and honor to be able to join you here for this important conference. I want to thank the organizers and attendees who are making this success possible, and I was happy to accept the invitation to deliver this address today. I will discuss Palestine rights work in the United States under the presidency of Donald Trump. Before we can appreciate the work that lies ahead of us, however, it's important to first understand the pre-existing context we operated in ahead of this Trumpian moment. Our organization is a coalition of over 300 member groups across the United States working for Palestinian rights. Founded in 2001, the U.S. campaign included organizations large and small, many of them represented in this room, of various identities and in various locations across the country. Prior to the advent of the BDS call in 2005, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions call, which I believe we are all familiar with in this room. The U.S. campaign was engaged in efforts to end U.S. military aid to Israel by focusing on Washington, D.C. Our organization is also part of a movement for Palestinian rights inside the United States and out. In the U.S. in particular, the Palestinian rights movement has a rich history which predates the establishment of Israel and was largely conducted by Arab American organizations for many decades. Advocacy for Palestinian rights relied on many traditional tactics, including educational and informational campaigns aimed at public opinion as well as congressional advocacy. Here it's important to say a word about the U.S.-Israel relationship. As you know, the movement for Palestinian rights is a global one, and it's important to send Israel a message from every corner of the globe that its denial of Palestinian rights is unacceptable. However, not all relationships are created equal. The U.S.-Israel relationship, more than Israel's relationship with any other country or group of countries, is the single most important relationship that Israel has. Washington's support for Israel is the very backbone of Israel's abuses. Without American support, it's hard to imagine how Israel could continue to employ its abusive policies. For this reason, our work here in the United States is both of great consequence, but is also very challenging. Just as we know the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship, so too do Israel's supporters and allies who are working to maintain the status of this relationship. Pro-Israel interest groups have invested heavily in developing and maintaining relations between Washington and Tel Aviv for decades. Thus, the traditional channels of advocacy, particularly as it relates to policy change, are extremely difficult for us to navigate. I cannot tell you the number of times members of Congress or their staff have privately, and even sometimes publicly, told Palestine rights advocates, "I agree with you, but if I did anything on this, it would cost me dearly." The extent to which a Zionist consensus exists on Capitol Hill would make you think that it is not a hill in Washington, D.C., but an Israeli colonized hilltop in the West Bank. No matter how many letters were written to Congress, how many phone calls were made by constituents, to members' offices, the efforts often came up empty. This, of course, had a very discouraging and demoralizing effect on activists engaged in Palestinian rights advocacy. So it was in this context that the BDS call arrived onto the scene. While the idea of divestment existed before 2005, and indeed divestment campaigns were being organized and even won on campuses prior to the 2005 call. Shout out to Hampshire College here in Massachusetts, who succeeded back in 2004. The call, nonetheless, 12 years ago, formalized the use of these tactics in a Palestinian-led framework for the first time. It's no exaggeration to say that the embrace of these tactics by Palestinian rights activists in the United States had a revolutionary impact on the movement. The call gave activists new ways to organize, new spaces to organize in, new targets to aim for, and, most importantly, an opportunity to win. Perhaps it was too difficult at the moment to get the U.S. government to address its complicity in Israeli abuses. But what about the complicity of various levels in society below the government level? There is the individual, community, organizational, institutional, and local government complicity that could be addressed by campaigns with specific targets. These campaigns could operate in an arena with far less competition than in the halls of Congress, making them imminently more winnable. This quickly translated to optimism, engagement, buy-in, commitment, and the desire to do more campaign-related work. Suddenly, an effort that had become debilitating and discouraging became dynamic, energizing, and empowering instead. In the United States, BDS campaigns have seen numerous successes in the past 12 years. On our website, you can view a list of all of the victories that have been amassed over this time. Two things immediately jump out when looking at this list. First, the sheer diversity of victories is impressive. Corporate divestment victories, church divestment, cultural boycott, university boycott, professional association boycott or divestment victories, and the list goes on. Second, the accelerated pace of these victories over time. In the early years after the call, victories were less prevalent, but in recent years they've been increasingly frequent as the use of these tactics grows. Our organization used to spend more time helping groups start campaigns, but now we do a lot less of that. Self-starting campaigns take off around the country, sometimes thanks to pre-existing resources, but often also out of the initiative of local organizers. Now, much more of our work and our time is spent coordinating and providing support for campaigns that are up and running on their own. So now that we've discussed the context as it relates to the great growth of the movement, it's important to understand the political context in the United States ahead of the election that brought us Donald Trump and the space it afforded for Palestinian rights work. During the Obama era, despite his stalwart support for Israel on par or beyond any of his predecessors, we witnessed an unprecedented shift in public opinion on Israel in the United States that largely followed partisan lines. This is significant because in American politics, even when Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree on whether it was night or day outside, they always, always agreed on Israel. Now, suddenly, this was starting to change. This change took place for several reasons that are very important to understand. The first was Obama the person. Barack Hussein Obama was elected the first black president of the United States, but to many in Israel, they could not get past his middle name, or the fact that his father was a Muslim, or that he spent time in Indonesia growing up, or that he had a dinner conversation once with Edward Said and was acquainted with Rashid Khalidi. Obama was also viewed with suspicion at the highest levels of the Israeli government because it was believed that Obama sympathized with the Palestinian narrative more than the Israeli narrative. The second factor was Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu's premiership in Israel essentially overlapped with Obama's presidency for all but a few months. Each government Netanyahu formed was a right-wing government strongly supportive of settlement expansion, which caused friction with Obama's Washington as they spoke of advancing peace negotiations. This tension was evident from the outset of the relationship between the two leaders, and Netanyahu's way of dealing with it was to change the subject away from peace, settlements, and Palestinian rights to Iran, 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 and did I mention Iran as well? This brings us to the third important factor in the partisan divide. That is the Iran deal. Obama viewed the region in a way that the Israelis did not like. He sought to stabilize it not through massive deployment, but through the pursuit of political agreements, and he saw an opening with Iran that allowed him to pursue the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which would bring Iran in line with its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. While this would result in an unprecedented inspections regime on Tehran's nuclear program, the likes of which the world had not seen, it would also mean that the Iranian government would be given a path out of the isolation the international community had imposed on it. Netanyahu and many in Israel who see no option other than the eventual regime change in Iran viewed this as a mistake and worked as hard as possible to torpedo the Iran deal. With nuclear nonproliferation being highest on Obama's national security agenda, the Iran deal would be a significant policy achievement that advanced American national security interests while also keeping a promise he had made on the campaign trail about the willingness to talk to the Iranians and advance relations out of mutual respect. The fight over the Iran deal was on, and it was a vicious one that quickly became hyperpartisan. For Obama's opponents, some of whom had accused the president of being too kind to American adversaries, and others who even claimed he was not an American and seeking to subvert it from the inside, the politics around the Iran deal was fuel for their fire. Many of Obama's supporters, though, not only agreed with the Iran deal for its national security objectives, but they also grew angry at allegations of traitorism against their president, which they saw as often racially coded language. Let me say a few words about these narratives. Pro-Israel advocacy in the United States has always come not just from Jewish Zionist voices or institutions, but from evangelical Zionist ones as well, a demographic that has for generations been at the base of the Republican Party. But it was more recently, during the two Bush administrations, that this constituency really started to flex its muscles. The confluence of multiple American wars in Muslim countries, 9/11, the War on Terror, and the Second Intifada helped sew together a clash of civilizations narrative that dominated the political discourse on the right and beyond. The discourse was clear about the axes of good and evil. Predominantly white, Judeo-Christian civilization was on one side, and Islam was on the other. Enter Hussein Obama. the first African-American president and the first physical manifestation of the minority-majority American future. Among the immediate reactions to Obama's triumph was birtherism, the Tea Party, and the narrative that undergirded both. Obama is not one of us. But these reactionary movements shared this core analysis with a more intellectual-seeming group. In right-wing neoconservative circles, the same narrative was congealing around Obama and one core issue, Israel. Take, for example, a book published in 2009 by National Review writer Michael Ledeen, which gave Obama a whole 8 months before rendering the verdict very clearly. The book was titled Obama's Betrayal of Israel. For others, where the verdict on Obama was still out, one question loomed large. Does Obama really feel it in the kishkis for Israel? Obama, of course, was as pro-Israel as any of his predecessors. But that didn't stop certain pro-Israel voices on the right, like Charles Krauthammer, who argued in a column titled, It's Obama vs. Israel. Searching for the source of Obama's hatred of Israel, Krauthammer wondered if it stemmed from Obama's penchant for appeasing enemies while beating up on allies. Or perhaps it was because Obama wanted to heal the breach between Christianity and Islam and has little patience for this pesky Jewish state. Over at the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol told us that Obama was angry, accelerating both his appeasement of Iran and his attacks on Israel. But there was good news. The Republican Party, he writes, and the conservative movement, and most of the American people, stand with Israel against President Obama. Kristol also set up something called the Emergency Committee for Israel, a right-wing attack operation intended to counterbalance J Street, which was seen as giving Obama Jewish cover. What was the emergency? It was Hussein Obama, just as the robocall supporting Netanyahu's re-election in Israel had called him. The Emergency Committee for Israel has now changed its name to the Committee for Israel since the election. I'm not joking. They've literally declared the emergency over now that the first black president has been replaced by the white supremacist in chief. Then you have Bret Stephens, who argued that Obama not only betrayed Israel, but that he had systematically failed to oppose every adversary, from the Iranian regime to Bashar al-Assad to Russia to the Muslim Brotherhood. And who did Bret Stephens say was most betrayed by President Obama, the first African-American president? Americans. This narrative flowed back and forth between these voices on the right, like Robert Spencer or Dick Cheney or Sean Hannity or Alan West, who wrote, for example, "The barbarians are indeed at the gate. But there are also traitors within our ranks. If Barack Obama goes to the United Nations Security Council and drops the veto in support for the two-state solution, I believe we will see the latter enable the former." Likewise, Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich, two of the President Trump's early supporters, helped carry the tune of dog whistles. Gingrich argued that Obama is so outside of our comprehension, he can only be understood by knowing Kenyan anti-colonial behavior. Mike Huckabee told Fox News viewers, everything Obama does is against what Christians stand for. He's against the Jews in Israel. Furthermore, he argued, the one group of people that can know they have his undying, unfailing support would be the Muslim community. And it doesn't matter whether it's the radical Muslim community or the more moderate Muslim community. But opposing Obama on Israel had a deeper impact than these pundits may have reckoned with. And it is well illustrated in an episode from 2016 involving Jennifer Rubin, who wrote a Washington Post column called Why It's Correct to Label the Obama Administration Anti-Israel. She concluded that the Obama administration was the most anti-Israel in history and a disloyal, unhelpful ally. But her article, which was typical of her output during the 8 years of Obama's presidency, had a ripple effect. It was amplified on a website called Breitbart News, which Steve Bannon called the platform of the alt-right, precisely because it reinforced their narrative. In other words, the white supremacist home base saw no contradiction between Rubin's analysis of Obama and Israel and their own worldview. And this is exactly the point. Not only did these pundits not contradict the ideological undercurrent of the alt-right, they provided a piece of the paradigm with their insistence over and over again on an us versus them mentality. The fight over the Iran deal, during which much of this narrative swirled, put Israel, Republicans, Islamophobes, and racists of various stripes on one side, and the president, Democrats, multiculturalists on another. It came to a climax when then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured an invitation to speak before a joint session of Congress through the Republican Speaker of the House, circumventing the White House purely for the purpose of lobbying against the president's agenda. This meant that the Republican Speaker of the House was cooperating with a foreign leader in an effort to derail the signature foreign policy objective of the American president. As a result, a stunning 60 members of Congress, senators and representatives alike, almost all Democrats, chose to skip the speech of Benjamin Netanyahu and held press conferences instead explaining why they did so. Many of them were members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The speech of an Israeli prime minister before the American Congress is a sickening display which has become known for featuring more standing ovations than the annual State of the Union address delivered by the president himself. So for 60 members of Congress to skip out on this high-profile address was a stunning rebuke for Netanyahu and a sign of the times. So this brings us to the fourth factor driving the partisan divide, an important one during the Obama era, and perhaps even more important during the Trump era, which is now upon us. And that is what Obama represented. Barack Hussein Obama represented a changing America, a majority-minority country which was headed in the direction of more people of color assuming decision-making roles. Obama represented a certain ethos that would be at the center of the political battle boiling in the next election. That ethos is one of civic belonging, one that prioritizes democracy over identity. American as an idea, not a color, ethnicity, or religion. America does not cease to exist if it no longer has a white Christian majority. The same cannot be said for the Israeli ethos, however. This is an ethos that prioritizes identity over democracy. Obama represented an America that was becoming more demographically diverse and was okay with it, or so we thought. Israel, on the other hand, considers demographic changes to be existential threats. This contrast became clear in the Obama era, and it became clearer still in the Trump era. So this brings us to the election just over a year ago today. The last American presidential election was probably the most covered and most followed political contest in modern history. It was a campaign unlike any other we had seen in the United States, pitting the most insider of insiders in Hillary Clinton against the most unorthodox of outsiders in Donald J. Trump. Neither of them was particularly good on Palestine or a friend to BDS. Hillary Clinton made a commitment on the campaign trail to combat the BDS movement, in large part as a response to her largest donor, Haim Saban, who has made fighting BDS a priority. Donald Trump's pro-Israel bona fides were laid out at the annual AIPAC conference and in many statements before and after. We prepared for a Clinton presidency. Why? Because every poll and almost every analyst had her winning comfortable. And frankly, how on earth could one prepare for a Trump presidency even if you thought he was going to win? Everyone knew Clinton was a vulnerable candidate. She entered into the contest as the only nominee in Democratic Party history to have an unfavorable rating above 50%. She was running against an opponent, however, who had an unfavorable rating close to 60%. While Trump may have been the only candidate Clinton could beat, the inverse was likely also true. How convinced were we that Clinton was going to win? We had an email prepared to go out to our supporters, loaded up, to blast out to tens of thousands of people saying something to the effect of, Clinton has won, what is next for BDS? One of the challenges we expected to arise that would impact our work should Clinton win would be the rollback of this partisan divide on Israel. We imagined that Clinton, who had committed to inviting Netanyahu to the White House in her first 100 days, would reset relations with Israel and make clear that there was no partisan divide. With Hussein Obama now out of the way, business as usual in the U.S.-Israel relationship would return. But of course, Clinton did not win, and we got Trump instead. We wrote a different email. While we were not expecting Trump, we were forced to begin thinking about how our work would change under a Trump presidency. Our initial thinking was heavily influenced by the sheer shock of what took place. Not only was the outcome a surprise, But what this outcome could mean could be devastating. Aside from the pernicious policies Trump supported towards immigrants, refugees, and the outside world in general, he rode to power on a wave of nativist, xenophobic white nationalism that would continue to be empowered after his victory. Trump had won despite making attacking the press a cornerstone of his campaigning, and he was surrounded by some key advisors who had a clash of civilizations mindset that advocated for eternal war with Islam. Some think tanks friendly to Trump had made combating BDS a priority, including through attacking Muslim American organizations that practice BDS, like American Muslims for Palestine, one of our coalition groups who has recently come under the crosshairs of legal targeting. And while he continued to attack minorities, he also continued to embrace Israel, and in particular, Benjamin Netanyahu. Take, for example, his behavior this past December when he was president-elect and the UN Security Council was voting on a resolution to condemn settlements that Obama ultimately permitted to pass by withholding his veto. Netanyahu worked to stop the resolution, and when the White House refused to commit to veto it, Netanyahu called Trump. Trump then called Egypt's El-Sisi, whose ambassador had introduced the resolution, and Egypt withdrew it. However, four other countries were prepared to move ahead with it, and the vote ultimately happened with a U.S. abstention. Trump, as he always does, let his thoughts be known to the world on Twitter, slamming the Obama administration for throwing Israel under the bus and promising that things would be different come January 20th, which was Inauguration Day. He had also promised to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem during this time. Netanyahu properly thanked him for his support on Twitter and looked forward to the new relationship. Soon, these two tweeting lovebirds would continue to exchange public messages of support. When President Trump made clear he wanted to build an even bigger wall to prevent immigrants from coming to the United States from Mexico, Netanyahu tweeted that Israel built a wall and walls work. Trump would soon cite him in a TV interview. Shortly after inauguration, it was announced that Netanyahu would be the first foreign leader to officially visit the White House after Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom. Netanyahu's trip was planned for February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day. The Love Fest provided us an opportunity. Trump was a remarkably unpopular figure in the United States and only becoming more despised, particularly among Democrats, including those who did not support Palestinian rights or BDS. Being in opposition to Trump is where all the energy, power, and dynamism was, and being able to brand Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu as Trump allies was a way to continue to open eyes in progressive and liberal circles in the United States. These two leaders were largely doing the work for us. But we took pleasure in launching the Bad Romance campaign, which was timed around Netanyahu's Valentine's Day visit to the White House. This video and petition campaign shed light on the common agenda between Netanyahu and Trump, as well as the chummy support they showed each other in curtailing the rights of darker-skinned people under their rule. Additionally, the Trump-Netanyahu love affair sent a shock through much of the American Jewish community, which votes overwhelmingly liberal. Trump's campaign brought all sorts of white nationalists out of the woodwork, leading to a spike in both Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents. Yet at the press conference between both leaders, the leader of the so-called State of the Jewish People provided backing when Trump faced the question about his campaign's role in fueling anti-Semitism. This showed what many of us had known for a very long time, that Zionism had a tolerance for anti-Semitism, and it was the idea that acted as its very raison d'etre. This attitude was once again on display this summer when Netanyahu's government retracted a statement condemning an anti-Semitic ad targeting George Soros, an Israel critic and philanthropist, in Hungary. Or when Netanyahu's son, Yair, or the head of the Israeli-American coalition, Adam Milstein, shared social media memes attacking critics of Israel using anti-Semitic tropes. The concert between Zionism, anti-Semitism, ethno-nationalism, and nativist racism is particularly appropriate to discuss as we reflect on the topic of this conference, the legacy of Arthur Balfour. Though he may be most known for aiding Zionists in 1917, it's crucial to remember that Arthur Balfour was, in fact, a white supremacist. He made that much clear in his own words. In 1906, the House of Commons in the UK was engaged in a debate about whether or not the native black population in South Africa should have a right to vote. Most members of Parliament agreed that the disenfranchisement of blacks was evil, but not Arthur Balfour, who almost alone argued against it. "We have to face the facts," Balfour said. "Men are not born equal. The white and black races are not born with equal capacities. They are born with different capacities, which education cannot and will not change." But Balfour's troubling views, of course, were not limited to Africa. In fact, despite his now iconic support for Zionism, he was not exactly a friend to the Jews. In the late 19th century, pogroms targeting Jews in the Pale of Settlement had led to waves of Jewish flight westward to England and the United States. This influx of refugees led to an increase in British anti-immigrant racism and outright anti-Semitism, themes that are not unfamiliar to our politics today. Support for political action against immigrants grew as the English public demanded immigration control to keep certain immigrants, particularly Jews, out of the country. In 1905, while serving as Prime Minister, Balfour presided over the passage of the Aliens Act. This legislation put the first restrictions on immigration into Great Britain, and it was primarily aimed at restricting Jewish immigration. It may seem astonishing that Balfour, whose support for the Zionist cause has made him a hero among many Jews, would have implemented anti-Jewish laws. But the truth is, his support for Zionism stemmed from the exact same source as his desire to limit Jewish immigration into Britain. Both can be traced back to his white supremacist beliefs. Balfour lived in an era of stirring nationalism, highly defined by ethno-religious identity. Because of these sentiments, the early 20th century was a time when ostensibly liberal Western nations struggled with the challenge of incorporating Jewish citizens. What the Zionists provided for Balfour was a solution to the challenges Jewish citizens posed to his ethno-nationalist vision, a solution that didn't force him to reckon with them. Instead of insisting that societies accept all citizens as equals, regardless of racial or religious background, the Zionist movement offered a different answer: separation. Balfour saw in Zionism not just a blessing for the Jews, but a blessing for the West as well. And he wrote in 1919 that the Zionist movement would, quote, "mitigate the age-long miseries created for Western civilization by the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it equally was unable to expel or absorb." By both giving Jews a place to go and a place to leave, Zionism seemingly solved two problems at once. In Balfour's mind, in other words, his support for Zionism was motivated to an extent by his desire to protect Britain from the negative effects of the, quote, "miseries" of having Jews in its midst. Rather than protecting the rights of one of its minorities, Britain could simply encourage exporting them, or at least not import anymore. Needless to say, his view of Zionism is steeped in the same kind of white supremacy as his views on South Africa's blacks. But his support for the Zionist dream had another problem. Rather than solving the problem of how to handle a minority living in a white-majority country, the Balfour Declaration just shifted the same problem into a different geography. For the tension between ethno-nationalism and equality is equally present today between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, where the Israeli state rules over the fate of millions of Palestinians who either have no right to vote, are treated as second-class citizens, or are refugees denied repatriation. Today, it is Israel that views Palestinians, like myself, as demographic threats, and sees, quote, "the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it was equally unable to expel or absorb." That Balfour's legacy of supremacy persists as much as British support for Israel is no accident. We have arrived at this point today because the supremacist attitudes of Balfour informed policy, lending imperial might to the pursuit of a project for national self-determination for Jews by trampling on the rights of native non-Jews. Remarkably, Balfour was unabashedly aware of the hypocrisy of his stance. Quote, "The weak point of our position, of course, is that in the case of Palestine, we deliberately and rightly decline to accept the principle of self-determination, he wrote in 1919. We do not propose to even go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country, the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. Those Arabs, of course, made up 90% of the population, if not more. My grandparents, along with, I'm sure, the relatives of many in this room, were among them. Therein lies the fundamental problem that continues through this day. 100 years later, Palestinians are denied the right to have rights because from the very outset, their views, their human rights, and by extension, their very humanity were consistently seen as inferior to those of others. That was clear in Balfour's perspective and the British Mandate's policy, and it persists in one form or another in the many policies of the Israeli state through this day. Today, as much as in 1917, the battle between ethno-nationalism and equality, between particularism and universalism, has risen to the foreground, from Donald Trump's rise in America to Theresa May's Brexited Britain. Rather than resolving this tension, Balfour's support for Zionism merely exported it to Palestine. The ideology that Trump rode into power favored a very similar Herrenvogt nationalism. It holds that a country is for a people, not for many peoples. Zionism fits this worldview very well. Exposing this to those in liberal and progressive circles in the United States who have not yet taken a stand on Palestinian rights will be one of our key tasks in the Trump era. Moving forward, we must do several things. First, we must build towards the S. While we have had success over the past 12 years in many B and D campaigns, there is much work yet to do to getting to the S, the sanctions. Israel's U.S. government-level sanctions on Israel would be a game-changer. And we should not shy away from or be intimidated by this objective. Rather, we must assess what it takes to get to this goal, be realistic about the time that it will take to get there, build the power necessary to march down this path, and do so unapologetically. This is a longer-term objective, and while it is unclear exactly how long it will take, it is clear that it is beyond 3 to 5 years. The question for us in the Trump era is how best to build towards this ultimate goal in the political context we operate in during this period. Now I want to outline challenges and opportunities on this path that we will encounter and will feature heavily in our work in the years to come. First, and perhaps most importantly, we must intersectionally organize. Something very important happened in the summer of 2014. As you all know, that summer, Israel bombarded Gaza for 55 hellish days, killing well over 2,000 Palestinians, most of whom, as always, were civilians. The war on Gaza received massive coverage in the United States, albeit primarily filtered through a pro-Israel lens, and was the lead story on almost every day of the summer and in every newscast. But what may be less known outside the United States is that in the second week of August, just as the war in Gaza was beginning to wind down, attention in the United States turned to the story of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old African-American from Ferguson, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. The unarmed Brown was shot to death by a white police officer and had his hands up at the time of the shooting. The case recentered the discussion about police brutality in the United States and the legacy of racism in American institutions, especially in law enforcement. But the fact that it came during the war on Gaza meant that those following the news, both on traditional and social media, were confronted by a striking juxtaposition. State violence aimed at upholding a system of injustice on the other side of the world and in our own backyard. As protesters gathered in the streets of Missouri only to be met with a harsh police response, activists from Palestine sent messages with tips on how to mitigate the influence of tear gas. Others circulated images of identical tear gas canisters used 6,000 miles apart, made by the same corporation in Pennsylvania. Palestinian keffiyehs could be seen in the streets of Ferguson during the protests. The connections were just too prevalent to ignore. This episode highlights one of the many intersectional organizing opportunities that offer a path to building coalitions with groups and movements who are unaware of our work and afford us an opportunity to support their work as well. There are intersections with Palestinian rights issues and various other issues of importance in the United States, including some that have come to the fore in the recent years and months after Trump. For example, did you know that the company that helped build Israel's wall in the West Bank and helped encage Gaza is considered to be the front runner for the contract to expand Trump's wall to keep immigrants out? Or that G4S, which has long been a BDS target, is deeply enmeshed in the American prison industrial complex? Long before Donald Trump banned refugees, Israel had its own refugee ban, preventing many of my family members, for example, from returning to their homeland. As awareness of communities of color coming into the crosshairs of state policy and rhetoric grows, the opportunities to create alliances, coalitions, and insert the issue of Palestinian rights firmly into the fold of progressive and liberal priorities continues to grow as well. Second, we must work to reform an anti-lobbying culture. An unfortunate byproduct of the success of BDS tactics is that it's directed grassroots energy away from focused engagement with policymakers in the federal government. As activists get used to working on divestment campaigns targeting either a corporation or aiming for a resolution in this church or that university, they're honing organizing skills for those campaigns while not developing lobbying skills needed for effective government engagement. As I noted earlier, BDS tactics provided something of a refuge for activists who were tired of getting nowhere with Congress. But here's the hard truth. There is no way to sanctions without going through Congress. This means that at some point that engagement needs to happen, and the sooner it starts, the better. This is not to say there's no engagement with lawmakers. There is. But there can certainly be much more, and there will have to be much more for us to achieve the goals we want to see, and the anti-lobbying culture that has arisen as a byproduct of focused B and D work makes this more difficult. Addressing this culture and correcting it will be a big task for us in the years ahead. Third, we must confront lawfare. An additional challenge we've been confronting in the United States, and I know there's going to be a workshop on this afternoon, is the lawfare efforts aimed at repressing the Palestinian rights movement by attempting to criminalize BDS tactics. We have seen multiple pieces of legislation in state legislatures across the United States aimed at this purpose over the last 2 years, and we have organized local coalitions to fight them, with success in some areas, but not in all. As a group of organizations with relatively small capacity in comparison to what we are up against, we must be careful not to get bogged down fighting anti-BDS legislation to the point where it is all-consuming. Tying us up playing defense so that we are incapable of playing offense and burning out our resources is precisely what our adversaries would like to see. At the same time, we cannot ignore such legislation. We must triage the situation and strategically address state legislation where we can. We are working with other groups to educate activists about their rights, which is a key component to defeating the chilling effect that these laws intend to inspire. While we do have President Trump, we also still have the Constitution, at least for now. What is so important about this is that unlike places like France, for example, where the state can take draconian steps against BDS activity, political boycotts are considered free expression and protected here under the First Amendment to the Constitution and have been upheld as such by the Supreme Court of the United States. For this reason, anti-BDS laws in the United States can only go so far before crossing a constitutional line that would open them to legal challenge in the courts. We have noticed that anti-BDS law drafters have attempted to tiptoe up to this line in some places, but elsewhere have crossed it, almost testing to see how much they can get away with. Legal challenges have already begun. This summer, an important battle against a piece of federal legislation called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act began. As written, it could lead to civil and even criminal penalties for BDS-type activities, with up to $1 million fine and 20 years in prison. We have seen the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, join alongside us to defeat this legislation. This is very important for several reasons. First, while we have been screaming at the top of our lungs about the unconstitutional nature of these bills, few took notice until the ACLU weighed in. Second, the ACLU is a very well-respected organization, particularly in liberal circles, and the fact that they have taken up this cause sends an important political message. Third, since the inauguration of President Trump and his attempts at instituting various rights-infringing policies, the ACLU has been a key institutional leader in opposing these policies, like the Muslim ban, for example. Once the ACLU weighed in, senators came under increased pressure to end their sponsorship of this anti-BDS legislation, and many have already expressed willingness to amend it or withdraw from it. It's not clear if this legislation would have ever come up for a vote. However, the legislation provided an opportunity to expose the repressive lawfare effort to a much wider audience. Now more people are becoming aware that Israel and its allies are actually trying to silence criticism of Israeli policy overseas. This very authoritarian tactic cuts against the ostensibly democratic ally Israel claims to be when it otherwise engages American audiences. Continuing to expose these repressive efforts in partnership with institutions that have been leaders in protecting free expression will be an important feature of our work moving forward. Lastly, we must work to build congressional support. We must work to build support in Congress for standing up for Palestinian rights. In recent years, we've seen important gains in this area, even though the energy of the movement has been more campaign-focused and not focused on the engagement of government. Last year, for example, 19 members of Congress signed a letter led by Representative Betty McCollum to the Secretary of State demanding steps be taken to protect Palestinian children whose rights are abused by Israeli policies. The letter even called for holding Israeli military units accountable under the Leahy Law, a provision which would deny aid or training to those units. This may seem unremarkable, but consider that 10 years ago, it was difficult to get even 5 members to sign a letter urging continued support for humanitarian aid to Gaza through UNRWA. Now we have 19 willing to sign on for conditioning aid. This year we worked on a similar letter calling for the protection of Isa Amro, a Palestinian rights defender who is being targeted by the Israeli military court system and is being forced to face trial on bogus charges. We were hoping we could get 25 names on a letter calling on the Secretary of State to advocate on his behalf and noting that the Israeli military courts are kangaroo courts with a 99% conviction rate. This advocacy campaign resulted in 34 members of Congress signing this letter. These numbers will continue to grow, and it is one of our main responsibilities to grow them. First, there will be letters, then there will be the introduction of legislation. Keep your eyes open for that very soon, and keep in mind, the first comprehensive sanctions bill for South Africa was introduced in 1972. It took 14 years before it could pass. But with unprecedented numbers of members taking steps to defy the intimidation of pro-Israel lobby groups, we find today the energy to redouble our efforts and continue to build. As their numbers grow, more numbers will feel safe in joining. We must work to build a core, first among progressive Democrats and then into the mainstream of American politics, that supports Palestinian rights, because Palestinian rights are as important as the rights of any other group. It's a long battle ahead, but it is a right battle. And I am proud and honored to play a role in it alongside so many of you around the world who want to see freedom, justice, and equality for us here in the United States and not last in Palestine. Thank you.
You have been listening to Yusuf Munayyer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, delivering the keynote address at the conference on the Balfour Declaration. And that is our program this morning. Tune in again next week for more presentations from the Balfour Legacy Conference held in Cambridge on November 11th.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Falkland's hero, Lord Carrington, departs this mortal coil, but we haven't heard much about his role in World War II, prolonging it by 4 months, or as chairman of Bilderberg. UK press, not a single obituary I could find, mentioned that Carrington was the chairman of Bilderberg for several years in the 1990s. And it's only the most powerful gang in the Western world. Better keep that off the historical record, eh? And so how did it go with Trump at NATO? Well, apparently the US is fed up with paying 80% of the cost of NATO. Unless the European member countries double their contribution from 2% of GDP to 4% of GDP, then they might just pull their troops and their contribution out of NATO and leave. Well, bring it on. UK has thousands of US troops here and a score or so of military bases. Some say the only purpose they're serving is to make Britain a target of Russian or maybe even Chinese ballistic missiles. Anyway, with me this evening is Bob Nichols from Bristol Against the Arms Trade, who's organised a walk and picnic on Sunday, taking in some lovely urban countryside and some of Bristol's two dozen or so arms companies. You know, the ones who are supplying weapons to kill innocent civilians in illegal wars in Palestine and Yemen, for example. And those companies who, while they're about it, are lobbying for war. Because, yes, some people do want a war. Some people make a lot of money. Also, the Israeli settlement program. We go to Gaza to take a look at the real reasons Israelis go to live there. And it's not just because they're surrounded by soldiers, and if any unarmed Palestinians walk anywhere nearby, they're liable to get shot dead. And also, we're going to have a go at getting to the heart of the matter. Where does it say in the Bible that Benjamin Netanyahu should behave like this, with his soldiers killing unarmed civilians? And if so many secular Jews, including Syrian politicians and military men, don't believe in God, then who promised them this land, if God didn't? Our sister show Dialects, back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week we'll be hearing from Gilad Atzmon, the jazz musician. He's very controversial. Some people call him anti-Semitic. But I've had a good look at what he's said, and actually he's been misquoted every time. And he'll be talking about all sorts of things. And we're going to hear a clip from him later, including the whole controversy within the Labour Party, but also as someone who was born in Israel, talking about the whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party are following the expression of God and what God is telling them to do in the Bible, which, of course, they're not. But anyway, Bob Nichols, we'll be talking about that a bit later. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good evening.
Hi. Now, you're doing a walk, I understand. Maybe you should just start by saying what Bristol Against the Arms Trade is and what it's really all about. It sounds pretty obvious, but do we have much of an arms trade here?
Bristol has a very long history of producing aircraft, mainly for military use, since probably before the in between the wars. I think they're producing airplanes for the First World War, and that's developed over and over the years into one of the largest conglomerations of aerospace high-tech industry in Europe.
I mean, if Airbus pull out, as they keep threatening to do, is that going to be good from your point of view?
Well, it's only relocating in terms of, like, a campaigner who's against the arms trade. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, I don't particularly want to see highly skilled people unemployed. That's not the goal of us as campaigners. That we would have another approach of, as arms conversion, as it were, really.
What does that mean?
Well, the it's actually there is a renaissance amongst, and there's been a proposition, or what they call it, within the Labour Party to consider arms conversion in high-tech industries that are producing military things, and based on the Lucas Aerospace plan 20 or 30 years ago, and which under these circumstances 30 years ago, a manufacturer, the workers came up with a plan because they thought they were all going to be laid off, to come up with different ways of using their skills to produce things more socially useful within society. So that, I think that's what we would love to see, really.
Now, you know what that reminds me of?
Go on.
Concorde. Because all of the skills that have been built up during World War II, after World War II in the 50s and 60s, were crystallised into something which didn't drop bombs and didn't fire missiles. So is that what you're trying to say? I mean, is that the sort of thing you're talking
about? Well, there's an argument against aircraft that are actually polluting and use vast amounts of energy. I mean, the Lucas Aerospace plan, I think they came up with about 300 from wind turbines, which in those days were quite high tech and really were very small scale. And that has, I mean, it's just gone on to prove, really, that if we did really put some money into that, we could, be world leaders.
So, so you're saying you don't want any aeroplanes at all? Not even the Airbus that we go on holiday on, EasyJet or whatever on?
Well, that's my own personal view. Well, I haven't flown. Well, I've flown once in an aeroplane to Edinburgh in 10 years, and I'm against the actual profligate use of oil, really. And airplanes are terrible for that. They're very polluting. I think it'll bite us back, really, in terms of pollution and energy use.
But, the only thing is, Bob, I mean, practically speaking, if you're working 24/7, all the hours God sends, and you get yourself a week off, you actually do want to get on an aeroplane and go somewhere nice and warm for that week and then come back. Surely the main real polluters are the business users of jets, not the whole people who go off, you know, maybe once a year on their holiday. Because quite often they could probably just have a Skype call with somebody, you know, rather than zip about as they do through Bristol Airport here and many other airports. It's the business users.
I think in a way you're right. I mean, why shouldn't somebody who's worked hard go off and have a holiday? But it's actually when you have there's a very very generous tax dispensation on airplane fuel, and actually it makes it ridiculously cheap, really, for people to go off and have, like, get drunk in Croatia, you know, for celebrate their mate's marriage or something, or other ridiculous, you know, pub darts team day out, or even myself, and I have to, like, own up to that, going off to Edinburgh to the Christmas sales. That is ridiculous. Why fly? I could go to Bristol. I could do it cheaply because, you know, the state or whatever, the tax system is subsidising that. I don't know quite why.
Well, I can tell you one of the reasons, and that's because when these aircraft can fly from country to country so easily, as they do, then it's quite difficult for one government to then say, we're going to have very expensive... I mean, imagine if you were driving your car like you would an aircraft all over the world, you would probably fuel up in the places where the fuel was cheapest.
Yes. I can't argue against that. So I suppose, it'll be very difficult to regulate.
As soon as you start putting big taxes on the airline fuel, you're going to find
go somewhere
people
else,
will
yes.
be buying yeah. it somewhere yeah. else. This yeah. is where things like the EU come in, isn't it? Where actually if you've got a big organiser, maybe they go to Iceland and they fuel up there, or Norway that's outside the EU. Anyway, look, tell us what you're up to on Sunday.
Sunday, it's an awareness-raising walk, starting off at University of the West of England.
The weather's looking good, by the way.
Ah, brilliant, brilliant. We've had one or two. We definitely won this year, if not two. They're quite long walks, but you can try and join us in on the way or leave as
now
you
you're
can.
You're getting me nervous now. How long is quite long? 10 miles?
You're walking from Ewy towards the big roundabout at the end of the Gloucester Road, so that's up by where Airbus is. It's quite manageable, really.
How many miles?
But in hot weather, you need to have a hat. It was very hot the last time. and some water.
How far are we talking about? How long in terms of time?
Oh, it'll be a couple of hours, yeah.
Okay, well, that's not too bad, is it?
Yeah.
That sounds like a mile.
No.
Well, a couple of miles, maybe. All right, so where are you actually going? So you can name us some of the arms firms that are here. This is what I'd be fascinated to hear, is what arms companies do we have here in Bristol?
Well, there's different layers of it, and it's been an interesting journey for me as well to find out how much is around as we were investigating this at a bit more depth maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And the walk starts at uni. Now, by significance of universities, they get paid by the military or government to for high tech research. Really, the initial sort of research for do military thing. Robotics is a good example. So Bristol and UWE are involved in that. And then the walk progresses just over the road to the business park owned by UWE, and. Surprise, surprise, we were over there campaigning against Raytheon, missile manufacturer, and then we explored, and there's all these other arms companies based there, using them as offices mainly. And why that is, because the other side of University West of England is the sort of defence procurement site, well known around Bristol, and which is a honeypot for big companies to promote their military... projects, really, because the armed services buy, usually it's when they have a they're multi-million pound projects. So there's a lot of companies, I should think, about at least 12 to 15 around the business park, producing different things, because they might be the new aircraft carriers or the frigates or the new troop carriers or the airplanes or whatever.
No, I think it's fair to say that nobody really minds you building weapons when they're actually genuinely for defence against other countries that might be about to invade you or attack you, like in the Second World War. You know, we got into a bit of a scrap with the Nazis and we did have to start building a lot of airplanes, then we fought the Battle of Britain, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And there is a definite sense of right and wrong sometimes in wartime as to who's right and who's wrong. And sometimes you have to make a stand. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that what Britain did in World War II was 100% right. Maybe there were mistakes that we made. But at the end of the day, the sort of rule that the Nazis were bringing out across occupied Europe and the mass extermination of communists, trade unionists, Jews, gypsies, all these types of people, wasn't really the sort of... well, we wanted to live in, was it? And so at that point, you do wonder, I mean, would you still try to defend the stopping of the arms trade in that kind of circumstance where we're fighting the fascist enemy?
I think it's the point of the walk is actually to raise awareness that there's a sort of creeping militarisation within society. I mean, to answer your question, your initial, is about our... Not all wars are just, and parallel with that, I think, is we all, at an individual level, maybe as a society, and maybe even as a European bloc, have the right to self-defence. So, you know, if somebody was attacking me, I'd feel quite, you know, I thought it would be okay, maybe to pick something up and I'd bash them back. And so... I'm not personally a pacifist, and I don't think our group is, but it's the same as you were speaking earlier about the issue of homes. It's actually being driven by corporations who want to make lots of money, and we could have quite an effective defence, but it doesn't have to be aggressive in terms of like expansive and wanting to take territory, which we did as a country in the sort of delayed days of colonialism. We could have an effective defence, but it doesn't have to be. It could be less, a lot less than to expand our defences would be ridiculous.
We are taking actually quite a major role in the war in Yemen at the moment, which has been classed as the most horrendous. I think it's several agencies, including the UN, saying this is the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet at the moment, where effectively you've got the Saudi Arabian military equipped and helped by the Royal Air Force and equipped with British aircraft, equipped with British munitions, dropping bombs on people. Now, I remember around about 18 months ago reading a report, a UN report. Was it the UN or was maybe one of the major news agencies saying that there were no military targets left in Yemen? So one wonders what this equipment is being used for.
I'm not exactly sure what's happening, but I guess, as in when the Israelis attacked Gaza, that actually what they do is destroy all the infrastructure, hospitals, which I think are being targeted, you know, in the more granaries, which hold transport infrastructure, things like water. I think they all get destroyed. So that's what, which is the groups that have arms out in Yemen are.
What I'm saying, I suppose, is something's changed. I always feel like the Royal Air Force now is a bit like the Luftwaffe was in Nazi Germany. You know, it's an aggressive force. It's going out to foreign countries and bombing people, often innocent people, often not military targets, and. You know, there's a sort of switch happened, a change has happened, which hasn't. It's almost as if we're supposed to still. We've had the 70th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, I think, or was it 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force this week. A big flypast in London. We're all supposed to be there clapping and cheering. The only thing is, these aircraft are not necessarily RAF ones, particularly, but RAF personnel are being used to help with targeting in Yemen, and that targeting cannot really anymore be military, and we've also heard that the kind of targeting that's been going on has led to the biggest cholera outbreak in modern history.
Yeah, so that's correct.
We're not really, it doesn't seem to me anymore, doing this for a positive purpose. Something's missing.
It needs a little clarification, because what we've been arming Saudi Arabia, who's so oil rich, for decades, and they haven't really done much with the planes we've been selling them. So maybe one of the princes has decided, you know, whatever, they've gone across their border and they're bombing Yemen because they feel they're a threat, I presume. That's it. So. And indirectly, we're obviously supplying the planes themselves is what we do. We do supply the missiles, definitely, because they need particular missiles fit to certain platform, as it were, the type of plane that we have sold to the Saudi Arabians. So it's not our pilots are there. But we do train them as well in Bristol. There's a training centre that's pretty local. It's one of the few places where there's sort of armed security, really, which I presume actually the Saudi pilots would come over and do there's an element of training there
Where's
to
that?
Use those. It's in Bradley Stoke somewhere. But I do know.
Is that part of your walk or not? It's a bit out of your.
No, it'd just get a ridiculously large walk. We've got a map, and it's on the WordPress website, and that's quite interesting to see.
I'll put a link
companies.
Up to that the map up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and a link to your site. So, what about drones? This is the modern thing, isn't it? And you know what bothers me most about drones is, I think, as the wars get more and more unjust and appalling, with the military being used to kill civilians, basically taking out poor countries. Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And these wars become more like massacres.
Yeah,
a lot of the military people actually find that they don't find it very palatable to kill people like this. And so the drone is a fantastic way of just getting it one step removed from the actual process of killing people in a so-called war, which is really probably better called a slaughter. I mean, have we got much going on in the way of drones around Bristol?
They don't actually make the drones in Bristol, but BAE Systems have one of their research sites is in North Bristol. And you can never be quite sure what they're doing, but they will be involved in the war. And they were developing a drone they were going to try and sell, because it is big business, and it's a new form of firing, as a platform. It's a lot cheaper than having a plane that costs $60 million, for each plane, to have a drone and use that. And we know that, again, missiles are designed that will go onto drones up at next door to BAE Systems at MBDA, and they are 100% missile manufacturers, and they're making a lot of money at the moment on what's going on in Yemen, because the missiles that go onto planes that we've sold to the Saudis. One thing about the Saudis don't have drones, to the best of my knowledge, so they're blasting away with the planes they've got there. So they're a step behind a lot of other countries in sort of their what they've got available to use. So it's a much more clumsy way of using these missiles. They're just still terrible things.
Well, if you look up the drone training school, yes, in Wales, you right, won't find what you're expecting, because we had an incident last month with a watchkeeper drone which crashed just outside a primary school. I don't know quite why the military were flying this thing on a test mission over the top of a school, but £1 million, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page too, £1 million military drone flew over a packed primary school sports day, and then everyone heard a crash. Watchkeeper drone crash was the fifth to hit the troubled development project, and it has led alarmed villagers in Penn Park, West Wales, to demand the Ministry of Defence change the flight paths of these unmanned aircraft. So the camera pans upwards, and it's a great little film. I'll definitely put this up on the internet for folks. The camera pans upward to reveal at least £1 million worth of British military hardware, a watchkeeper drone, still in its test and development phase, flying over a packed primary school sports day attended by 100 children and a similar number of adults. The same afternoon, the drone flew over Penn Park School on another almost identical watchkeeper crash just a couple of miles away from the village primary school, in the process narrowly missing a 70-year-old boy who was having his first driving lesson.
Was this a local one, Tony? This is in Wales?
This is in Wales.
Oh, right, yes.
Journalist here from the independent newspaper is saying, the Defence Watch says the crash will raise further doubts about the wisdom of the watchkeeper programme. Now, again, apparently it's cost £1 billion altogether, and these things just don't seem to work. They keep crashing.
I was very knowledgeable about the drones maybe a couple of years ago, and there are only two test sites in the UK for testing drones, but Salisbury Plain and the area around, I think it's Perranporth or something, I can't remember.
Penn Park, it says here.
Penn Park. Okay, I've made it. I think it's an old Air Force base.
I'll say is, yeah, if in you Wales, live in one of, yeah, the villages around Salisbury Plain, as some of my friends do, you better watch out for these things, because they clearly keep crashing. They haven't quite got it right. And they should be keeping them away from primary schools. But look, to get back to the main issue, we're also, Abbey Wood is massive, isn't it? It's,
yes,
the big MOD procurement. Last time I spoke to the journalist Mark Leftley about this, they were in a process of actually privatising it, which I could not quite believe, that a US arms company could actually run the procurement programme for the Ministry of Defence. Now, do you know to what extent that's being privatised? Is it being privatised, Abbey Wood?
It does sound ridiculous, but I suppose at many levels that's quite possible, because a lot of it is like infrastructure, so a lot of it can be, and I can't remember if it's Balfour Beatty or one of those big companies who have international, are going to take over and run the
whole.
Could
it be Carillion, by any chance?
Well, that's I think the company's just like the Golden Goose.
Actually, they won't lose money. Actually, Carillion did have a contract to build some MOD stuff up there, I believe. But anyway, no, it looks as if that was scrapped. That, I mean, I'm not sure. This is under the Cameron government, the plans for the Ministry of Defence procurement to be privatised. I mean, it just it's incredible.
They could part do it because obviously there's things like cleaners, and then there's security, and then there's managing the building. Obviously, a lot of the employees there are actually employed by the MOD, so they'd never be employed by a private company. Why it fell through, I don't know, because it would be maybe it was a political decision, really, rather than practical.
Well, just digging up one of the most recent articles about it, the Ministry of Defence wasted £33 million on various botched attempts to privatise procurement. A report claims, and the benefits outweighed the issues, apparently. And that's, this is, again, it's Mark Leftley, good old Mark, the Ministry of Defence. He said the MOD, and this is back in 2015, wasted £33 million of our money on botched attempts to semi-privatise the £14 billion budget agency that buys military equipment, according to a report published by the National Audit Office. So they've stepped in, rather like they did last week with Universal Credit, and criticising Esther McVeigh, the Work and Pension Secretary, saying, look, what are you doing? You're actually just throwing this money away. So Abbeywood is quite an important site, isn't it, nationally?
Yes, it's before Abbeywood, each of the services had their own site. The Navy were over in Bath. I don't know where the Army was, or Air Force. And they made sense to put them all on one site, have a modern building. And so all these employees that are doing... Well, I mean, part of it is like actually just buying basic things, boots, say, for example, for soldiers, but also it's the very high-tech which draws the big companies there, really, for weapons, really, or weapons delivery, or whatever you like to call it, which are very, very costly. They involve lots of money, and they... design. There's quite a lot. Obviously, private contractors have to design them, really, or they work with the industry. The military will set a specification, say, okay, we want a tank that does this and that, and goes have a certain turret, and then the private company will go off and design and come up with certain products, and they compete for that. That's it. That's why there's so many people there. And an awful lot happens there in development of weapons.
Is it a site that's expanding? You know, just, I mean, I think, isn't it? Like I said, there was a Carillion contract up there a few years ago. Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure. I thought it had shrunk maybe a couple of years ago. Just I don't know why. But sometimes these things spread out. There's another... a bit of an overlap with the University of West of England, a sort of robotics centre, which is in a nearby building. So that links in with drones.
Before we get on to some clips, we're going to listen to a few clips in a minute to do with Trump and things like that. Just remind us, whereabouts is your whereabouts are you setting off from on your picnic on Sunday?
Right, it starts at 11 a.m. at the bus stops on the University of West of England French A campus. So that's the main entrance where there's a roundabout.
So you can get glorious metro bus up there, I guess, can you?
I think you can now, can you? I've never used it yet, so... But so the start, or some people are meeting in the centre at the bottom of Christmas Steps to catch the 70 or 71 bus up to Uey. That's at 10 a.m.
Are they boycotting metro bus?
I don't know how they...
maybe there's some parts on it from one of these arms firms. Anyway, look, the time is starting at Uey is what?
11 a.m.
Okay.
On Sunday.
And where exactly at Uey?
At the bus stops that students use. It's at the main entrance.
Okay. And you reckon it's going to go on how long?
It'd be at least a couple of hours. My colleague likes to... to talk a lot, and it is fascinating. He's an ex-teacher, very knowledgeable, and we'll have some fun and learn loads.
Are there any pubs along the way?
One at the end for a refreshment. You've got to bring your own refreshments
just to sort of coax you along. Anyway, one of the big events, and you maybe get some comment from you, Bob, on this in a minute, this week, is the death of Lord Carrington, Peter Carrington. He was the Defence Secretary under Margaret Thatcher, and he was actually Defence Secretary during the 1972, and under Heath too, under the 1972 Bloody Sunday attacks in Northern Ireland. So really, he was the guy where the buck stopped at Bloody Sunday, where I think it was 10 or 11 protesters, rather like it's just been happening over in Gaza. Protesters who were unarmed were then shot by soldiers over in Northern Ireland, which is one of those main events which actually kicked off the Troubles, which then went on to last until 1998, the Good Friday Agreement. So he was the guy who the buck stopped with on that, Peter Carrington. I haven't seen really anything about that in any of these obituaries. The other thing was, when he was a young man, he was in the Grenadier Guards in the Second World War. He was involved in the liberation of Holland, which was called Operation Market Garden, features so well, actually, in this film A Bridge Too Far, where they charge along a road, the army do, and the various bridges along the road over the rivers are taken by the paratroopers, the 101st Airborne, the United States, the 82nd Airborne, the United States, finally the bridge at Arnhem, which is taken by the 1st Airborne. At least they managed to cling on by their fingernails. And on Wednesday, the 22nd of September 1944, Peter Carrington was one of the first tanks, in the Grenadier Guards, to cross the Nijmegen Bridge. And I had a conversation with one of the veterans from the 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, who saw him, came up to him. He said, "Well, we've taken this bridge now. Get down the road, because your guys are dying at Arnhem." And the conversation got a little bit heated, and he said, "Well, you've got to go, because we've just taken this bridge, so you can go down there and take the Rhine River, because your guys are hurting at Arnhem." And he cocked his Tommy gun, pointed it at Carrington's head, and said, "Get down that blankety blank road now, before I blow your blankety blank head off." And this was the orders of the ground troops at Arnhem were to take that bridge and hold it, but not to move forward. And after the war, there was a British colonel called Robert Kershaw. When he was over in Germany, he interviewed the Nazi commander, the SS colonel, general actually, who was in charge of the defence of Arnhem and Nijmegen during the war. And he said, "Well, the British made a mistake when they stayed in Lent, which was just over the bridge in Nijmegen. If they'd have carried on, it would have been all over for us." And so Carrington, being threatened with a gun from the US troops to carry on, as he had a whole corps of tanks, that is to say at least 100 tanks that could have gone down that road and actually helped the British survive at Arnhem and claim the bridgehead, almost certainly, he decided not to go. And he actually hopped into his tank, put the hatch down so that the American soldier couldn't get at him. And that was told to me directly by Moffat Burris. And you can hear that and see that up online in various places if you look him up. MoffatBurris. So that was Peter Carrington's role there. I also spoke to Major Tony Hibbert, who was actually at the bridge at the time in Arnhem. And he told me that they all thought that if those tanks had come that evening, because they decided to stop for 17 hours until the Germans had finished off the British at Arnhem Bridge, the war would have been over by Christmas. And so thank you, Peter Carrington, for your role in making sure the war didn't finish in December 1944, but carried on until May. And of course, the tactic here really was to extend the war to allow the Nazis time to squirrel their money away around the world, and also to make sure that the Russians and the Soviet Union forces did the bulk of the fighting towards Berlin. And that's why they took Berlin and we didn't, because it seemed as if there was deals being done at the highest level, particularly Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's private secretary, with the Nazi hierarchy. They wanted to take the money that the Nazis had looted from World War II and then give some of the top Nazis safe passage after the war. And they also wanted a lot of the technology, of course, including things like enriched uranium for the Nagasaki bomb. Anyway, so let's have a little listen now to a quick clip from Parliament this week from David Lidington, who's the minister in the Cabinet Office, who was sitting in for Theresa May, and also Emily Thornberry, their take on Lord Carrington.
Mr. Speaker, I have been asked to reply. My right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, is attending the NATO summit in Brussels. Mr. Speaker, I know that members from both sides of this House would like to join me in paying tribute to Lord Carrington, who died on Monday. His was an extraordinary life of public service, including as Defence Secretary, Foreign Secretary, and Secretary General of NATO.
Emily Thornberry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Minister of State in paying tribute to Lord Carrington, who served his country with such distinction in both the forces and in government, and whose decision to resign the office of Foreign Secretary will be remembered as an act of great principle and honour.
Well, that's very nice of Emily Thornberry. Also, Carrington was Secretary General of NATO. Bob, what is NATO's role these days? Because I think it was supposed to be a North Atlantic Treaty Organisation that was a defensive pact, a defensive agreement, in case the Russians rolled their tanks across Europe?
My understanding, it was developed, yeah, it was in the times of the Cold War when the threat against sort of the West was Russia. There's an alliance of half a dozen European countries to have a military agreement, really. And Paul,
it's his role as chairman of Bilderberg I found most irritating that wasn't included, because this was during the time of what was happening in the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, which was actually a fantastic in many ways example of how you could do socialism without it being authoritarian as the Soviet Union was. Anyway, that's all about that for now. Let's have a listen now to this. We're going to go over to Israel now. We've been hearing a lot about Gaza, a lot about the killings by the Israeli Defence Force in Gaza. Probably not enough on the mainstream press about that. But the question is, why are these Israelis there? Because as many people have pointed out, most of them are not there for any kind of religious reason. They don't have any kind of religious faith or belief at all. But a lot of them want to take the land because God gave it to them. So what is going on?
Close to Jerusalem, the best view, the best weather, close to my parents. Yeah. Excellent, it's perfect.
These people don't own guns. They don't lock their doors. I visited 15 settlements out here in the West Bank to find out what motivates the people who are at the forefront of one of the world's most difficult and protracted conflicts. The West Bank is home to 2.2 million Arabs and seen by the international community as the part of a future Palestinian state. But there are also more than 400,000 Israeli settlers living out here, which is about 5% of Israel's population. Many of the first Jewish settlers who trekked out here in 1967 were driven by a strong ideological mission to claim this land for Israel. But things have changed quite a bit since then. Spend 10 minutes in a settlement today, and you sometimes feel that you could just as easily be in a New Jersey suburb. Clean roads, big houses, quality parks, good schools, close by shopping, a university. You ask people why they moved out here, and instead of the original mission to push forward the Israeli state, you hear things like
a very good educational system.
This is a very nice country club.
We wanted to be able to have a bigger place.
It's a great place to raise kids.
It's just a beautiful view, and it's our beautiful land, and I love looking at it all the time.
We were looking for a Jerusalem suburb that we could afford that was a manageable commute.
Close to Jerusalem.
Extremely close to Jerusalem.
The quality of life is so much better. It has nothing to do with politics. Having a little bit more quiet.
Most people here work in the city, and you come back here at night, you come back here in the afternoon, and it's just relaxing and quiet.
Between the puppet show for the kids, the bump-in bar mitzvah party, and the 100 other examples of seemingly ordinary suburban life, it's hard to remember that these settlers are living at the edge of an intense conflict.
My wife and I had certain criteria. One was we wanted to walk out of our back door and be hiking in 5 minutes.
Now, of course, there's still ideology here. Many residents of these communities feel connected to the settlers' original mission to resettle the hills of the ancient Judean Samaria from the Bible, which they call
the cradle of our entire civilization.
Yeah. But ideological motivations for living out here are usually four or five items down the priority list, with quality of life reasons being the main drivers.
To tell you if my ideological reasons was the major motivation to move over, that wasn't one of the major things. I wasn't trying to make a statement. I was trying to find a place that would be a good place, a safe place to raise our kids. And this was the choice.
The hardcore back-to-the-earth settlers still exist. Here I am with a guy who doesn't want his name or face in my video. He lives in another outpost, illegal even to the Israeli government. There's no baseball league or bagel shops in this community.
God promised to us that this is our land and we can grow here if we listen to him.
This renegade culture of taking over hilltops once characterized the settlement movement.
If you've always felt a deep yearning for Jerusalem, now is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity not only to stand within its gates, but also to build the home of your dreams there. The tranquility of a picturesque setting and crisp mountain air with all the benefits and amenities that Jerusalem has to offer. Ramat Givat Ze'ev is adjacent to the city of Givat Ze'ev and is connected to Jerusalem via two main highways.
But make no mistake, there's still a conflict here, an occupation of land that has enormous impact on the lives of Palestinians.
This, it sounds paradoxical, but this just seems like the safest place in the world.
One of the reasons why life in many settlements is so peaceful and pleasant is that the government invests proportionally more public money into the settlement communities than it does in mainland Israeli communities. Schools in the settlements receive better funding than mainland Israeli schools in the form of better salaries for teachers and other educational benefits for the kids. Nearly one-third of all subsidized housing in Israel is in the settlements, even though only 5% of Israelis live there. And in the past, the government even ran a mortgage subsidy program that made living out here much cheaper than mainland Israel. And things like public transportation are cheaper for settlers than mainland Israelis. An Israeli think tank found that the government spends about $950 on each West Bank resident. That's more than double what it spends on people living in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
I can't hide the quality of life that people are enjoying here, okay? I can't hide the fact that people are moving from the United States from very luxurious big homes and they choose to live in Efrat. They're managing to maintain a very similar quality of life.
On top of government support, lots of the gyms, theaters, and parks in the settlements are funded by foreign donors, usually Americans, with ideological motivations. Even these unauthorized outposts that are illegal under Israeli law enjoy a good amount of support from the government. Like this government provided soldier to protect this illegal community, or a playground that's built by the government, as well as public waste and recycling collection, all in a place that has been deemed illegal by the government. To appease the international community, the government still tries to appear tough on these unauthorized settlements. Back on that illegal outpost, my contact tells me that the authorities show up about once a year to knock down a settler's house and then take a picture of it to show the world that they don't tolerate illegal settlements. But in reality, they clearly do. The original mission of the settlement movement was to claim land deep into the West Bank, preventing a Palestinian state. Any proposal for giving Palestinians their own state now has to take into account the hundreds of thousands of Israelis living out here. No one seriously considers it possible to remove all 400,000 residents. And while negotiations are in a standstill, Israel keeps issuing permits and settlements continue to grow.
These whole peace talks are like two guys negotiating over a pizza while one of them is eating a pizza.
Just a few weeks ago, the housing minister announced that he foresees this region called Gush Etzion growing from 7,000 residents, which it is currently, to 500,000 in the next 10 years.
What did you think that I was living in? You thought I was living in some sort of tent? That I was riding camels? What did you have in your imaginary picture, the settlement movement? There are 500,000 people living here. in solid homes.
Before 1996, there were 100,000 Jews living over the Green Line. Today, we're approaching 500,000. And that number is just growing. Jewish people have come home. That's not going to change.
Well, that's part of a video by Johnny Harris. Excellent video, I'd say. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But now it's time to have a listen to Gilad Atzmon, who's got all sorts of interesting things to say about this whole idea of whether God gave secular Jews this land. What I'm asking you about, though, particularly, is how what Netanyahu does, his policies and his party and his government's policies, relates to the biblical scripture, the Old Testament, the Torah, the Talmud.
Of course. You see, in order to tackle such a question, and it is a very important question, you have to produce some background. Now, your question is very important, especially because Netanyahu doesn't look exactly like an Orthodox Jew. We don't see him with a skull cap. Many members of his government and his Likud party are not religious. In fact, his government is quite hostile to those Orthodox Jews who refuse to serve in the army. So what is happening here? In order to understand it, we have to accept the Jewish, and this is why I concentrate on the J word rather than the Z word, Zionism, Jewish identity and Jewish identification are very unique notions. So, for instance, if you are a Jew and you decide that you don't believe in God, you're still more than welcome to consider yourself as a Jew. As we know, most of the Jews that we know around us, for sure, are secular and they still identify as Jews. If you are a Muslim, and this is very different, and you decide that you don't believe in God, you stop being a Muslim. If you are Catholic, not believing in God, don't go to the church, you stop being a Catholic. You remain British. If you are Muslim and you don't believe in God, you're not Muslim. You are Pakistani or British or Palestinian. Jews somehow sustain their Jewish identity while not adhering to any Judaic religious concept. And here is the revelation. The notion of Jewishness is way more crucial than Judaism. We have to ask, what is it the Jews sustain even when they drop God? And this is the concept of chosenness. There is a very interesting development that happened in early Zionism when Herzl is trying to negotiate. Herzl, probably the most significant Zionist forefather, the inventor of this idea, he finds himself negotiating with different superpowers about the possibility of having a land for the Jews, a Jewish national home. And Herzl himself was quite open to many ideas like Uganda and so on and so on. And he brings this idea to the First Zionist Congress, and their reaction is very strict. They say, are you mad? They say, no, we want Palestine. He said, why do you want Palestine? They say, because this is our promised land. He said, according to who? They say, according to God. but he says, you are not religious. And the answer is, we are not religious, but it's not the exactly the religion. This is what our identity is all about. So we can understand already then, in the first days of the Zionist project, that the notion of Zionism, the notion of the Jew within the Zionist context, is slightly more complicated than a strict religious belief. Now, when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu, and to a certain extent also his foes within the Labour, their transformation of the Judaic thought is very clear. What they really did, they replaced the Talmud with the Old Testament. What do I mean by that? Judaism, the religion, Orthodox Judaism, is an adherence to the Talmud. The Talmud is very similar to the Sharia. In Islam, it's a book of laws. To be a Jew is to follow laws. Those laws are defined by the Talmud. Zionism splits the Jew from the Talmud, and it makes the Torah, the Old Testament, into the Zionist prime religious text. And this is why Israel becomes the promised land. The promised land becomes the highlight of the Zionist project. While promised land wasn't at all an issue for Orthodox Jews all along their diaspora, and we are talking about something like 1900 years. And by the way, for Orthodox Jews, Israel is still not a promised land.
Okay, so we've got a situation where the majority of the Zionists, and particularly the Likud party, these people who are governing Israel, have decided that they're really not interested. They're more secular than biblical Jews, but they still want to retain this the idea of chosenness, which you said. But if they're chosen, who are they chosen by, if not by God?
Definitely. Listen, I'm not defending this idea. I'm not trying to say that it is rational. But I will tell you something that is slightly embarrassing. Who is the Jewish God? The Jewish God is a pretty problematic character when you think about it, yeah? When you look at the Old Testament, it's not the most ethical creature around. And you ask yourself, how can people believe in such a God? How can people believe in a God who calls them to invade another people's land, and take their wells and take their land, and all the quotes are for us in Deuteronomy? And my answer is that it is actually the Jews who invented God that somehow managed to choose them over all other people. So it is the Jews who determine the nature of God rather than God that determine the nature of the Jews. And this is why the Jews are very flexible with their God. When they don't like their God after Auschwitz, they drop him. Or air, you know, now the Jewish feminist rabbis think that God is air. You know, he's a female, you know. And they drop him. And in fact, I argue that Judaism is just one Jewish religion amongst many. At a certain stage, communism was the new Jewish religion, and Marx, became the Messiah. And after a while, it was enlightened egotism, and Ayn Rand became the Messiah. And at a certain stage, moral interventionalism became more interventionism, I should say, actually, and became the new god, the neocon god, sorry, and so on and so on. And I came to realize that Jewish religion is a very flexible concept that facilitates chosenness. So if you are a Jew and you want to become a Bolshevik, it is totally fine because you are chosen. You believe yourself to be better than anyone else because you argue that everyone is equal. Obviously, it's an absurd, yeah? And neoconservatism can make you feel chosen because you believe in moral interventionism. You do it, you do all of that. You know, you're killing other people in the name of human rights and so on and so on. Basically, Coca-Cola. So I think that we are dealing with a very flexible identity that can take many shapes. And if people want to understand what it is, they have to accept that the concept that they are studying is shifting as they try to understand it.
That's Gilad Apsman, the jazz musician. Very controversial, but anyway, he's going to be on Dialect next Tuesday at noon, a special with him talking about all these things, particularly looking at anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And I'm looking at putting something together in a few weeks' time, which is getting some of his detractors to get into discussion with him. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8, coming up live on Facebook with Arabian Nights, possibly. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, that's Rich Carey, Cy Jones, Labour councillors, Paul Smith and Afzal Shah. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we spend the hour looking at the events of September the 11th, 2001. We're joined by longtime advocate for 9/11 justice, 9/11 researcher, and author John Gold. His recent work is We Were Lied To About 9/11, The Interviews. In the first part of the program, we're joined by Jenna Orkin. She's a journalist whose latest book is Ground Zero Wars, The Fight to Reveal the Lies of the EPA in the Wake of 9/11 and Clean Up Lower Manhattan. Please stay with us for an hour about 9/11 issues you won't hear in the corporate media.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, We Were Lied To About 9/11. We were certainly lied to about a number of things regarding 9/11 in terms of the government reports, whether it was the 9/11 Commission or other subsequent inquiries. On today's program, we're joined by author and activist John Gold, who recently published a book, We Were Lied To, about 9/11, The Interviews. This is a 31-episode series of interviews that John Gold did that was actually transcribed into a book. So John Gold joins us today on the Project Censored Show. He's a longtime advocate for 9/11 justice, a 9/11 researcher, someone that has worked with the families and the 9/11 first responders to get truth, accountability, and justice for what happened that day, as well as health care for the responders. Along with many articles, John Gold has authored two books, 9/11 Truther, The Fight for Peace, Justice, and Accountability, and We Were Lied To, About 9/11, The Interviews. John Gold, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, Mickey, thank you very much for having me on today. It's been a long time. Indeed. I look forward to the discussion.
Absolutely. Absolutely, John, and as do I. We're also joined by Jenna Orkin, who is a journalist whose short film, Engaged, Carolyn Gage on Stage and Off, has received a top indie film as well as an L.A. Shorts Film Award. She's also the author of four books, the most recent of which is Ground Zero Wars, The Fight to Reveal the Lies of the Environmental Protection Agency in the Wake of 9/11 and Clean Up Lower Manhattan. Jenna Orkin, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
Jenna Orkin, I just want to remind listeners, before we started the Project Censored Show in 2010, I was one of the organizers of an event out here at University of California, Berkeley called Lifting the Fog. And the first session of the all-day event focused on the environmental fallout. And among a few of the panelists and experts, you were one of them. And that was way back in the fall of 2006. So you have been at this for quite some time, and I'm really glad to get you on the program today. Also, so listeners know, in this new book that John Gold has published, We Were Lied To About 9/11, Jenna Orkin was the first of the 31 expert interviews. So again, we'll be talking to Jenna about her area of expertise surrounding the events of 9/11. John Gold, let's start with you, since this was definitely a labor of love on your part. Could you tell listeners, what was the impetus? This is a series of in-depth conversations with experts about the problems with 9/11 research and the official narrative, but it's not your typical challenge to official narratives as we often see in the popular media. So, John, tell us, how did this come about, this project?
First of all, I broke my back within the last 5 years or so, so I'm homebound a lot, and I often find myself free with time and nothing to do. So I told that to you, and you told me to write the book.
Really? I guess I did.
And so I took your advice, because I thought, as soon as you told that to me, I thought that was a great idea. I had done these 31 episode interviews with just amazing people, and a lot of people digest things better when they read them. And I just want to say that I did not personally transcribe the 31 episodes. I had Michelle Fergus do it. I hate transcribing. Also, Scott Ford designed the book cover, and he also designed five posters that are available to download at the site We Were Lied To About 9/11.com. I basically wanted to write a book that had what I thought were the best of the best, the most influential to me, people who were part of the story, you know, the actual story, the people that could tell us about documented lies, journalists, whistleblowers, former Senator Bob Graham, and all kinds of things, including Mickey Huff of Project Censored. My first guest was Jenna Orkin, and Jenna was extremely influential to me in the beginning. In the September of 2004, there was something called the 9/11 Omission Hearings, which were held in New York City. And Jenna was one of the speakers there. And she had talked about the environmental impact of 9/11. And it never once occurred to me the kinds of things that could be taking place as a direct result of what happened, because the news wasn't telling us anything. This was the first time I had ever heard of anything. And remember, the 9/11 first responders were our heroes. They were constantly shown on the television. They reminded us that they were our heroes and all these things. And then you turn around and lie about the environmental impact of 9/11, resulting in thousands of them getting sick and over 2,000 dying already. So that was so impactful to me. And just watching the story about the environmental impact over the years has just been just so heartbreaking.
Well, indeed, and I know we're going to go to you, Jenna Orkin, here in a moment, because that's certainly, as John just pointed out, your area of expertise, and you in New York have long been researching and speaking out about these issues and cover-ups, which are so significant. But John Gold, just very quickly wrapping up sort of our intro here to your project, and we'll talk in more detail about some of the folks that you spoke with. But, of course, Jenna Orkin was the first person you spoke with. You certainly were kind enough to reach out and speak to both me at Project Censored as well as Peter Phillips. Peter Phillips was director of Project Censored during the 9/11 events, and Project Censored, of course, covered a number of 9/11 stories, some of which were quite controversial. And as you know, and certainly as you also know, Jenna Orkin, that's kind of a third rail in U.S. politics, one of those issues that you've got to toe one line. In fact, there's usually only one line with a very modest differentiation, and deviating from it will cause some swift blowback from the establishment, right to left, in fact, and probably can talk about that later, too. But, John, just before we get into talking about the environment here with Jenna Orkin, what do you hope will happen with this series of interviews? What is your hope that people will ultimately take away from this?
Hopefully it gives a clearer picture of what the history about 9/11 is in terms of context, truth, accountability, and justice, and the lack thereof, and how absolutely absurd that is when you think about how many things have been done in the name of 9/11. And we don't even know the truth about that day. We have a lot of ideas of what happened, but we don't concretely know. And isn't that a shame in and of itself that 17 years later, we don't know the full story about 9/11? Because those who should be able to answer our questions refuse to do so.
Well, indeed, John Gold, and your interviews get to the heart of a lot of the unanswered questions and a lot of material that's been ignored by the corporate media in the U.S., that's for sure. One of those issues, of course, does include the environmental fallout. And Jenna Orkin, this is where you come in. World Trade Center Environmental Organization, WTCEO.org. That is a website that you started. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that site has a vast amount of information regarding the issue of the environment, environmental fallout, and 9/11. And then, of course, subsequently, your book, Ground Zero Wars, The Fight to Reveal the Lies of the EPA in the Wake of 9/11 and Clean Up Lower Manhattan. Can you explain to our listeners what exactly is this controversy? And I know listeners of the Project Censored Show are likely aware of some of the environmental concerns, but a lot of the focus around 9/11 controversy, certainly around 9/11 alternative narratives, we hear a lot about the so-called controlled demolition thesis. We hear about Israel and Mossad. We hear about, even some have argued about, no planes, which is unfortunate because that is a serious distraction and not factually supportable. But this is a real, tangible, concrete issue that you really sunk your teeth into. Could you tell our listeners how you got involved with this issue regarding the environmental concerns in Lower Manhattan from 9/11 and more about your trajectory and your path and what you've learned?
My son was going to school four blocks north of the World Trade Center, and the school's parents and the general population was very gung-ho about returning to the building ASAP. I was not, and I wanted allies, so I went to a whole lot of meetings to get information that I could present to my ex-husband or to my son. Either one would do, because then you'd have, you know, the ratio of 2-1, in order to pull my son out of the school. I failed. I didn't get him out until February, and by that time the fires were out. But anyway, I became very aware of how the government was lying and of the cover-up, because I went to every conceivable meeting and hearing to extract whatever I could to convince my family. So what they were saying, what the EPA was saying, and what the press was dutifully reporting was good news, the air is safe to breathe, and we haven't found any asbestos. And, you know, they would harp on asbestos, and you have to question why they did that in the face of the thousands, literally, of contaminants that were released. But anyway, first of all, the tests that they did for asbestos were using outdated equipment. So for every fiber of asbestos that EPA found, independent scientists found nine. So the risk of cancer from the asbestos alone could be one person in 10. So that's number one. They used the wrong equipment. You won't see that in the New York Times. And then later on during the cleanup, they did related shenanigans. For instance, they were supposed to use fans, and they would either not use the fans or bring the fan and face it in the wrong direction or not turn it on. I mean, you can imagine the permutations were infinite. And then they would use tests deceptively. So one of the things they did was to use a 1% standard for asbestos. That percent is applied only in the case of intact material. So if you have, let's say, a pipe that contains 1% asbestos, it's considered an asbestos-containing material. But that's when the pipe is a pipe, and the danger is very small, but there, that a fiber of asbestos will escape. Well, they use this 1% standard for pulverized asbestos, where everything is inhalable. And so that was another form of deception. And then there were things like EPA Region 2, which was the New York region, got a phone call from EPA Region 8 out in Montana, where there had been an asbestos mine and multiple cases of cancer and a cleanup. So Region 8 was very expert in equipment, and they called Region 2 and said, we can get you up-to-date equipment. And Region 2 said, we don't want you cowboys here. And that's a quote. So that's the asbestos. And then you had dioxin. Well, we had six times the record level of that, you know, at one of the monitoring stations around Church and Day, I believe. And there was lead in the 50,000 computers. It'd be, you know, around 4 pounds per computer, 50,000 for only World Trade Centers 1 and 2. Then you had the pH level. And the way they lied about that was that by taking the level down from 11 to 10, they said, you know, we only found a level of 10. And that looks like a very small, inconsequential change. But in fact, that scale is logarithmic. So when you go from one to another jump on the scale, you've actually multiplied by 10.
Kind of like the Richter scale for earthquakes.
Yes. So when they went from 11 to 10, they were not reducing it by 9%. They were reducing it by more like 90%. Well, you never see that in the New York Times. And then Dr. Thomas Cahill of UC Davis tested for very and ultrafine particles. He found the highest levels of any sample he had ever taken, and there had been 7,000 taken around the world, including at the burning Kuwaiti oil fields. So this is just an example of the thousands of contaminants that were released. And also the synergistic effects were never addressed. And an example of that is that if you're an asbestos worker and a smoker, two bad things. You might think that that's twice as bad as being one or the other. In fact, what Mount Sinai found is that it's 80 or 90 times as bad. That's how synergy works. That's an explosive effect. Well, they didn't even go near it. They didn't even touch the cumulative effects.
Mount Sinai is the medical center in New York.
Yes, and it's the one that's treating Ground Zero workers now. So that lays the groundwork for what was in the air. And then the way the media treated it, well, that's complicated because everybody was working together. In other words, when there were hearings, the government told, by that I mean the EPA or the other agencies, told the state and city council or whoever was holding the hearing, we will not come unless you let us testify first. And they always got their wish. So they testified first. Well, knowing full well that the press had a deadline to meet and would vanish before the ragtag scientists who weren't allied with the government got on and told the truth. That's exactly how it worked. So by the time the noble scientists got on, there was really nobody there to hear it, if a tree falls in the forest and
right.
All of that. They did not get reported.
The head of the EPA at the time was former Republican governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, who on September 18th made the public announcement, quote, "I'm glad to reassure the people of New York that their air is safe to breathe," end quote. And in fact, this is all on your website, by the way, WTCEO.org, all these files, these documents and links. The New York City Health Department said residents are advised to use a wet mop to clean up their apartments. And again, unfortunately, knowing something about asbestos myself, given my father had mesothelioma, and in fact, one of the panelists at the event Lifting the Fog that we did in 2006 at Berkeley, where you were a present, my attorney, Nate Mudd, was there and talked all about the problems of asbestos, the cover-up for decades that had gone on about it. And, you know, we were relating some of these things to 9/11, and that was, again, back in 2006. So from out of the gate of 9/11, we see that there were cover-ups and very serious problems that we know have had very long-term and tragic consequences for more than hundreds, but into the thousands of people. I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are talking today with Jenna Orkin, a journalist and author. Her most recent book is Ground Zero Wars, The Fight to Reveal the Lies of the EPA in the Wake of 9/11 and Clean Up Lower Manhattan. We are also joined by John Gold, longtime advocate for 9/11 justice, 9/11 researcher and author. His most recent book is a collection of interviews titled We Were Lied To About 9/11. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with John Gold and Jenna Orkin. Please stay with us.
Now you masters of war, you that build all other guns, you that build the dead planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind death. Just want you to know that I see through your mask. You have never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world. Like it's your little toy.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're revisiting the many lies associated with the events of September the 11th. We're joined by author John Gold. His most recent work is We Were Lied To About 9/11, The Interviews, where he goes in detail with 31 experts about 9/11 issues, from NSA whistleblowers, media experts, journalists, etc., foreign policy people, people that were involved in the FBI, etc. We're also joined by Jenna Orkin, journalist and author. Her most recent book is On Ground Zero Wars, that takes a look at a lot of the environmental fallout from the 9/11 events. Before the break, we were talking with Jenna Orkin. We were kind of getting a history of what happened after the events and what was being left out of the corporate press. We ended with Christine Todd Whitman's quote. Jenna Orkin, let's just wrap on this little segment and then move forward to some more about first responders. Isn't it, in fact, the pressure on Christine Todd Whitman through the government to make such claims, was that not related in some way in your mind to Wall Street opening up the banks, the trade, and then right down to just the theatrics of it with then-Mayor Giuliani, Rudy, who was telling people to not wear protective equipment and protective gear at Ground Zero because it would incite public panic?
Right. And I wanted also to say something else about what was happening at the school. Because there was not only the World Trade Center site itself, there was also all the debris that was being transported to a barge, which was on the north doorstep of my son's high school, which was the first Ground Zero school to reopen. It reopened on October 9th, and the press made a big deal about that, of course. The Ground Zero workers were actually advised not to wear masks, even when they wanted to. They said they were forbidden to, some of them. because it was going to strike panic in the hearts of the public. So the students were very keen to return to the school because they loved that school. So we didn't get much support from them at that time. But the barge was on the north doorstep, and that's where a lot of the garbage was brought, and it was sucked into the ventilation system. The school had undergone $1 million cleanup, but that had not included the ventilation system, and the Board of Ed blatantly lied about that to the Parents Association, who didn't find out until everybody was moved back into the building. So there were a couple of kids, isolated incidents, of kids who didn't want to stay in that building, who felt uncomfortable. And one girl went to the head of the Board of Education, who had prominently and ostentatiously set up his office there at the school for a week in order to show everybody. And she said, "I don't feel safe. I don't think the air is good." And he said, "Well, you can leave the school, but if you do that, you can't ever come back." So she stayed. And within a couple of days, he was out of there. By February, this girl had to have 2 spinal taps because of a buildup of fluid in her brain, which was diagnosed as pseudotumor cerebri. So that's one incident. And then you had a girl who had her first asthma attack in 7 years after swimming in the pool, which had not been cleaned. And there were lots of cases of people being diagnosed with chemical bronchitis, new onset asthma, and so on. But the Board of Ed said, somewhere in the book I have a quote from the deputy head, who said, "We believe these incidents to be psychosomatic." That was party line for a long time.
Well, anything to downplay any kind of culpability or responsibility. And, of course, this is in the immediate aftermath, in the first 6 months aftermath of what's going on with 9/11. And, of course, John Gold, you've also talked, it took like a decade nearly before the government was really pushed into responding and helping to fund health care for first responders.
The government did not want to give health care to the 9/11 first responders. And at first, after James Zadroga died, the medical examiner of New Jersey found that he died from black lung disease. Then the medical examiner of New York found that, I think he said he died from drug overdose or something to that effect, essentially calling him a drug addict. And that put a bad light on him, and his father and the responders were furious with Mayor Bloomberg at the time, who I think said he wasn't a hero. And it was just a one big mess after the other. And the whole time, the responders are trying to get health care, to make sure that they're taken care of, which they 1,000% deserve. And yes, it did. It took over a decade, longer than that, to get permanent health care. They now have the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, which will last 75 years. And recently that came under threat. There was Trump is going to move it from one organization to another, and that would impede payments to people and so forth. But, quote, "A bipartisan effort by 4 members of New York's congressional delegation has helped scuttle a Trump administration move to transfer a program handling critical health care issues for 9/11 first responders." That was June 28th, Newsday. So that's been averted. One of the things about Jenna Orkin's talk that did to me, you know, that one of the biggest hurdles we've had over the years is the idea that elements within our government could have been criminally complicit in 9/11. And just that's hard for people to contemplate. But when Jenna spoke and she showed me just how, you know, much they're willing to put Americans at risk, and it was to reopen Wall Street, that's well documented, it just boggled my mind. If I had a hurdle in my brain that said they would never hurt Americans, she destroyed that. That was very early on in my activism. That's one of the reasons that she was one of the first guests that I had on, because I wanted people to understand just what this government is capable of doing. And if you look up the definition for second-degree murder, it perfectly describes what took place in the environmental impact of 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11.
And it was actually then host Jon Stewart over at The Daily Show that started shaming and berating members of Congress for dragging their feet on this topic. That's correct, right?
Yep.
I'm saying that because there were people on the ground doing it as well, right? So many activists, so many people like Jenna and others.
Oh, yeah.
But he had this mantle, right? He had this platform. So it's also an interesting thing to show the power of media. You know, when you have these platforms and you do speak the truth and say things, it's amazing that they can start creating some of these political changes. Jenna Orkin, just want to come back to you. Could you tell our listeners, if you know, and if you don't, maybe John, you can chime in, how many people, in your estimation, did the environmental fallout impact, or do we even know? And how many people have already died with traceable ailments?
We cannot possibly know because the incubation period for cancer is so long. So we were told early on, around 2002, that you won't really start to see the cancers until 20 years on. Now, it's only been 17 years, and it's already patently obvious that there's a correlation. And so it's even higher than we've been told to expect by one of our well-informed allies. Of all the many different varieties of cancer, I believe there are 70 that are considered related to World Trade Center, but they're constantly adding them as they see more results, and plus other illnesses that aren't cancer.
Well, Mount Sinai even talked about signature issues like World Trade Center cough, etc. I mean, in addition, like cancers. I mean, there's a whole host of things that went on in terms of health. And again, many people have already died as a result of exposure to toxins there.
I've seen numbers that say well over 2,000 9/11 first responders have died. So 2,977 were brutally murdered that day. Add an additional 2,000 to that, you know, 5,700 people have died. Aside from all of the people that we've killed overseas as a result.
Right. So, Jenna Orkin, I just want to wrap a little bit on the environmental segment so we can talk more about some of the contents of John Gold's interviews. But what are you working on now as far as the environmental issues, and what do you see to be the current focus of what's happening with these ongoing problems?
I think that after the Ground Zero workers started to fall ill and become activists, I felt that I could retreat from that aspect because when I did it, I, as a parent, was one step removed, and I did things that other people were not doing. The Ground Zero workers are phenomenally effective activists because they're heroes and they are obviously sick. Nobody can deny it. So they're doing that. And when I did the book, that was my way of encapsulating the entire story. I think that while there's a lot of regret about the Ground Zero workers, I don't think people understand the depth of the government's nefarious lies on this.
One thing I'd like to bring up is that we are now at a point where at least one 9/11 first responder dies a week.
That's astounding in terms of the fact that 9/11 is still ritually invoked by politicians of both major corporate-backed parties as a way to justify whatever draconian policy, foreign or domestic. And we should remember those in historical context going back to the events of 9/11. Jenna Orkin, WTCEO.org is a site that has a lot of the information of the environmental fallout. There have been a couple of films, including Dust to Dust, The Health Effects of 9/11. Dust and Deceit was another. Certainly, I've taught a course on 9/11 issues for, I think it might be almost 15 years now, and I always include these topics and resources because I think that they're still of significant importance to us. Jenna Orkin, any other last-minute things you want to throw in here in terms of a website, a place for people to find your book, or anything else?
They can find the book on Amazon.
Okay, so just look for Jenna Orkin.
Ground Zero Wars.
Okay, so Jenna, J-E-N-N-A, Orkin, O-R-K-I-N, and Ground Zero Wars is the title of the book. Jenna Orkin, thank you for your work, and thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Mickey.
I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned in to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, your host, and when we return from our musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with John Gold about several key concerns related to the events of 9/11, so please stay with us.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are looking at the many different lies associated with the events of September the 11th. Earlier in the program, we were talking with Jenna Orkin about the environmental fallout of 9/11, who is also one of the people interviewed for a collection of discussions that was published by John Gold. John Gold's book with 31 interviews is titled We Were Lied To About 9/11. John Gold, earlier in the program, we heard from you about what pushed this project forward, and you sort of teased us with some of the guests. Of course, Jenna Orkin was the first of those. But you also have interviewed so many other prominent experts, most of whom have been ignored by corporate media. So, John Gold, talk to us a little bit about the contents of your interviews and the kind of people that you wanted to include and why.
Again, you know, I wanted people that were part of the story for the most part, as well as the best researchers out there. My last interview, which I didn't think was going to happen, which I actually hoped would be my first interview, was with Paul Thompson, the creator of the complete 9/11 timeline available at www.historycommons.org. That was almost a four-hour conversation, and that was a wonderful conversation. But, you know, I spoke to as many people that were part of the story as I could. I spoke to Lori Van Auken, who was the Jersey girl, one of the four widows responsible for the creation of the 9/11 Commission. Think about that we would not even, as corrupt and compromised as the 9/11 Commission was, we would not even have had that if not for the family members, the Jersey girls, or the September 11th advocates, whatever you want to refer to them as.
The George W. Bush administration, in fact, lobbied Congress to not formally investigate the crimes of 9/11 and tried to derail it at every turn for over 400 days. And again, this is one of the – Lori Van Auken is one of the fabulous interviews that you did, and also the subject of a film, 9/11 Press for Truth, which is, again, a pretty old film by now, but definitely tells that story. So who else, John?
Ray Novoselsky, who was the director of 9/11 Press for Truth, which was the story about the cover-up from the perspective of the 9/11 family members, the Jersey girls, as well as Sally Regenhart, Bob McElveen, Monica Gabriel. And it basically, in my opinion, destroyed the legitimacy of the 9/11 Commission within the first half hour. It opened up a whole slew of topics that really weren't covered to the extent that they should have been. And it was based on Paul Thompson's amazing complete 9/11 timeline. So that was an important interview. I spoke with Eric Larson, and Eric is one of the people who was responsible for going to the National Archives and putting online for people upwards of 8,000 documents from the 9/11 Commission. And I dedicated that show to John Judge. Basically, John was a big fan of looking at documentation, official documentation that may contradict what are being made as public statements by politicians and so forth. That's a great way of showing that they're lying. So that's kind of what we talked about. I had Cindy Sheehan on, who's a Gold Star mother, lost her son in the Iraq War, has been a huge anti-war activist. I had New York Times reporter Phil Sheenan, who was the New York Times reporter at the time of the 9/11 Commission, was tasked with covering the 9/11 Commission for the New York Times. And each interview has a description of what the show is going to be about and what it is going to show you. For instance, for our second show, which was Chapter 2, Episode 2, I said, this week's show is going to focus on how the corporate media has treated those who question what we were told about 9/11. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that many people with followings won't talk about the multitude of cover-ups concerning 9/11. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that many people think that 9/11 truthers or advocates for 9/11 justice are the equivalent of a baby killer or a dog torturer. It is greatly because of how the corporate media has treated us that we have failed to reach the critical mass necessary to resolve this issue. If the corporate media did its job, I would not have had to devote almost 12 years of my life to this cause. I ask you, in what world does it make sense to constantly attack and misrepresent those seeking truth, accountability, and justice for the murder of 2,977 people? You know, certainly not in the world I choose to be a part of. And that entire discussion was about the problems with the corporate news, which is such a big issue for not only the 9/11 issue, but for every cause.
Indeed, John Gold, and that goes back to Nick Johnson, FCC commissioner from the 60s and 70s, who wrote a book called Your Second Priority that said just that. No matter what your first issue or cause or concern is, if your second isn't on media freedom, media reform, or press freedom issues, you're likely to gain little traction in your first. And, of course, that's definitely true of 9/11. You know, Philip Sheehan, by the way, wrote a book called The Commission, right, looking at the history of the 9/11 investigation. And, of course, historiographically, I know some people disagree with some of the conclusions that might be there. But, again, I think it's important to look at the 31 interviews you did because they actually have a pretty broad perspective. It's not just any one particular angle. I guess you could argue that all of the people you talk to at least have a general agreement that we haven't been told the truth about 9/11 and we don't know.
Absolutely.
Right? All the details about 9/11. And again, I find that to be hardly a radical premise. And I only say that because of the blowback, the attacks and so forth that you have received, that Jenna has received, for saying things that are just on the face of it, just fundamentally true.
Absolutely. And here's another show that I did with 9/11 whistleblower Colleen Rowley, and this is the description for the show. This week's show is going to focus on the importance of whistleblowing. Many people have put their jobs, their lives, and their freedom on the line. If not for many of the whistleblowers that have come forward, we would not know about much of the corruption taking place within our government and elsewhere. They are an essential part of having a true democracy, and in my opinion, should be treated like the heroes that they are.
John Gold, let's talk very briefly, if we can, about Colleen Rowley, because just like you mentioned earlier, one of the hurdles people had, the hurdle that you said Jenna Orkin helped break down for you and remove for you, the idea that the U.S. government wouldn't do X to its own people, etc. And in the case of the 9/11 environmental fallout, we can see what's capable, right, what they're capable of. But in this other case, mentioning Colleen Rowley, she was in the FBI, correct?
Yes.
And a whistleblower. One of the issues you often hear with people that claim to be skeptical about 9/11 alternative narratives, rather than skeptical about the official narrative itself, is that, well, there would be people coming out and saying things, and there would be more whistleblowers. Well, I mean, come on. You've got Thomas Drake. You've got Colleen Rowley, many others. What about Colleen Rowley?
Well, Colleen Rowley, very early on, Robert Mueller made a statement saying to the effect that it was news that some of the alleged hijackers trained at flight schools and inside of America. And if they had known that, they might have been able to avert what had happened. But the fact of the matter is, since 1996, flight schools have been targeted for investigations as far as, you know, Middle Eastern men training to fly and stuff like that. So she wrote a letter or a memo saying that statements like that should not be made. And a few days later, Robert Mueller said the magical two words that most people in the Bush administration were saying, was that there were no warnings.
From Kofor Black to Colleen Rowley, the CIA, multiple countries' intelligence agencies, I mean, even just internally here in the U.S. with the FBI and CIA, we knew that there were so many issues going on. People were being warned not to board planes, high-profile people the summer of before 9/11 took place in 2001. And again, Colleen Rowley is a classic example. By the way, that Robert Mueller is the same Mueller that is being both lauded by liberals but now somehow castigated by conservatives, the same Robert Mueller. So you mentioned Colleen Rowley as someone that had warnings that were ignored. Again, all the while people saying, well, there was no way we could have known that this would happen, right? I mean, including Condoleezza Rice, who testified to the 9/11 Commission that they had no idea planes could be used as weapons, even though she delivered a report to then-President Bush basically saying exactly that.
One of the things that George Bush used to say a lot is that if he had any inkling whatsoever that there was going to be an attack on American soil, he would have moved heaven and earth. And it seemed like a talking point because he used to say that quite a lot. And within the last 2 years, Condoleezza Rice made virtually the exact same statement, which just tells me that was just one big talking point.
One of the key tenets of propaganda is repetition. We certainly see that. So you also spoke with Nafees Ahmed, who has done the Crisis of Civilization, NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, the great scholar and deep state researcher Peter Dale Scott. You also spoke with Ray McGovern. Some of our listeners may remember Ray was just recently pummeled by officers of the federal government in D.C. for his protests of the Gina Haspel hearings to be the lead torturer at the CIA. You spoke with Abby Martin, Robbie Martin. You spoke with Peter Phillips, the former director of Project Censored and my former co-host here. And you also talked to someone. I'd like to hear if you had a few things to say about this particular author. You spoke with Jonathan Kay.
Before I get into Jonathan Kay, this book is very important because a lot of the interviews took place at the time when things like ISIS were being formed. And we were telling people the absolute truth of how ISIS came into being. So it's a great historical perspective. And there are other things like that within the book that were taking place in real time that we talked about that were important. Now, with regards to Jonathan Kay, Jonathan Kay wrote a book called Among the Truthers. He interviewed a multitude of people, a lot of people I would not have recommended that he interview, as opposed to other people. And he essentially put everybody into a bad light. So I interviewed him because I wanted to show how wrong he was about the subject. And I think I did a fairly good job at that. But one of the things that he did and he discussed, and this is something that we've been seeing all around, Jonathan Kay was considered a neoconservative. He belonged to an organization where Michael Ledeen belonged to it, James Woolsey. I forget what it was called, but it was a neoconservative think tank. And what he told me during the interview is that, no, he doesn't consider himself a neoconservative anymore. And like many, quote-unquote, neoconservatives, they're now admitting that the Iraq war was a mistake. Some of them are. And those are the ones that seem to be becoming neoliberal. Like a lot of the neoliberals seem to be or adopting a lot of the views of people who we used to consider neoconservatives.
Which actually was evident in the last presidential election, right? When so many of these people, Kagan, Kissinger, etc., so many of these people were drifting to the Clinton campaign. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with authors John Gold and earlier Jenna Orkin. We're talking about the issues surrounding 9/11. We're talking about the many false statements. And we're actually talking about a book and a series of interviews with John Gold titled We Were Lied To About 9/11. We'll conclude our conversation with our guests after this musical break. Stay with us.
They bombed innocent people trying to murder Saddam when you gave them those chemical weapons to go to war with Iran. This is the information that they hold back from Peter Jennings. This Condoleezza Rice is just a new age Sally Hemings. I break it down with critical language and spiritual anguish. The Judas I hang with, the guilt of betraying Christ, who murdered him, stole his religion and painted him white. Translated in psychologically tainted philosophy, conservative political right wing ideology. Together sloppily, the blasphemy of a nation. Got my back to the wall, cause I'm facing assassination. Guantanamo Bay, federal incarceration. How could this be? The land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous holocaust, and the home of the slaves. Corporate America, dancing off beat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sparks a terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's episode, we look at We Were Lied To About 9/11, which is a series of interviews put into a book by John Gold. Earlier in the program, we were speaking with author Jenna Orkin about the environmental cover-up and fallout of 9/11. And John Gold, before the break, we were mentioning some of the many different people you talked to and the many different angles that you explored. And I know one of the things that you've highlighted in a lot of the different interviews you've done is the failure amongst the journalistic class or our so-called free press, as Mark Crispin Miller would say in aerial quotes. So let's talk about that. What do you have to say about the way journalists have handled some of these false statements and ongoing cover-ups regarding 9/11?
Well, as I said, if real, legitimate journalists had done the job that they should have done, and many of them tried to do it, you know, their jobs, but they were let go. Robert Scheer, another example of that. But journalists who have written stories without the filter that we were lied to about 9/11, that we don't know the truth about 9/11, they're helping to write a history that's simply untrue, that's dangerous, because it allows the establishment to continue to use that day as it has been used. It has to stop. It just has to stop. And I wrote in my book, in the introduction, I said, to those journalists who consider themselves alternative press but don't incorporate the fact that we were lied to about 9/11 or don't know the truth about 9/11 into whatever post-9/11 related story they report about, I have this to say. You are helping to create an extremely dangerous environment. History is being written, and it's simply the wrong history. Please consider your stance on the issue of 9/11. Thank you. You know, I can't be any more candid than that, really. You know, and we're seeing today, like ICE. ICE is an issue now. Why did ICE come into being? Because of 9/11, specifically. You know, Department of Homeland Security, ICE. These are things that were created as a direct result of 9/11. And if we were lied to about 9/11, that takes away the justification for these organizations.
Certainly the post-9/11 wars, General Wesley Clark even warned that these were planned. 7 countries in 5 years. These invasions were planned. The Project for New American Century and neocons wrote about this in Rebuilding America's Defenses in 2000 and in another document in 1998. They came to power with the illegitimate and unelected presidency of George W. Bush. And these policies, however, have been continued by both major parties through Obama, continued through Trump, and now have extended to even more countries. I think that you would agree that a lot of journalists and even historians, there's this idea of letting go of some of the challenging matters of 9/11. And it's in the rearview mirror. And, you know, the train has left the station. And why would it matter if we go back and show X about 9/11 now? And again, I think that one of the major reasons is, A, getting the historical record straight for posterity. B, today's fake news is tomorrow's fake history. And C, because it's the right thing to do, right? And there are consequences today that we are seeing that still have their tether to 9/11. And you mentioned a big one, immigration, and the ban from these different countries in the Trump administration, locking up immigrants at borders because they're, quote, dangerous. I mean, look, those have long been ideas in American history. But in the 21st century, 9/11 is really the catalyst for those kind of policies, John Gold.
Absolutely. You know, we have Gitmo. We have warrantless wiretapping. We have the USA Freedom Act, which replaced the Patriot Act. We have all of these things that are a direct result. The wars are still being fought using 9/11 as the legal justification to do so. People have we murdered and slaughtered and wounded and displaced in foreign countries that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. This is a crime, a massive crime against humanity being done in the name of that day that we don't even know the truth about. And that's just horrible. And the families both deserve and require absolute truth, justice, and accountability for what happened. And I'd like to quickly say something about the families. Some of the families right now have started a site called www.declassify.com. 911.org, and it has a petition for people to sign, because the families and those who pay attention want everything having to do with 9/11 released completely unredacted, which we have not seen, even though in 2009 the 9/11 Commission said that they would release all documentation, and they have yet to do so. I think only 35% has been released, and a lot of it is redacted, and so on and so forth.
I know you've done research about this, and that's one Philip Zelikow, who's a PhD historian. He was one of the lead editors behind the 9/11 Commission report that was published, and there are hosts of conflicts of interest around Zelikow. Can you remind our listeners about him? And I believe he's at the University of Virginia now.
I believe so, but I don't know if he's teaching at the moment. You know, he wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice. He essentially wrote the preemptive war strategy to get into Iraq. He essentially was responsible for making sure that Richard Clark was no longer part of the cabinet, that he was put into a subordinate position. This was the counterterrorism czar of the day. During the time of the 9/11 Commission, he was responsible for the questions that would be asked, who would be questioned, and he would set up the 9/11 Commission so that it was, you know, nobody could talk to each other, or the staff couldn't talk to the 9/11 commissioners. Many of the staff secretly would talk to the 9/11 commissioners to warn them about things that Zelikow was doing. And I just want to remind people that Zelikow was selected by Karl Rove, and also Thomas Kean was selected by Karl Rove. First off, how trustworthy is Karl Rove? Obviously not at all. So there were allegations during the time of the 9/11 Commission that Karl Rove was speaking with Philip Zelikow, and Zelikow told his secretary to destroy the notes or to not keep records of the phone calls. My God, it's such a conflict of interest. He was doing everything within his power to rewrite the 9/11 report so that it was more favorable. He blocked half of the interview requests for Saudi investigators. He blocked Dana Liesemann, who came from the Joint Congressional Inquiry, over to the 9/11 Commission, who helped to author the 28 redacted pages that were made famous. And he blocked her access to them. And as a result, she went through a back channel to gain access to that information. And as a result, Zelikow fired her. And unfortunately, she has passed away. So, you know, the further away we get from 9/11, the harder it's going to be to get to the truth. You know, Philip Zelikow, as far as I'm concerned, he belongs in prison.
Well, I think Philip Zelikow plays an interesting role here, because he was mostly out of the public eye. He's an academic historian. He had serious conflicts of interest. He was a political appointment. In fact, the lead legal counsel to the commission, James Farmer from Rutgers Law School, called the whole thing a whitewash from start to finish. And again, this is pinned on Zelikow, the historian, who's tasked with creating the official narrative, right? I mean, and so, again, you know, when you have this much effort at really controlling the kind of questioning or that is or isn't allowed and what the acceptable viewpoints are, that's a lot of cultural power and authority. And when you have a lapdog press instead of a watchdog press that is cheering on these wars, cheering on these as necessary in the light of 9/11, you know, we have a lot of work cut out for us, John Gold. And both you and Janet Orkin have done a lot to cut through the fog here. And Janet Orkin, with whom we were speaking earlier in the program, has done so much work about the environmental fallout. Ground Zero Wars is the title of her recent book. Also, John Gold, your recent book is We Were Lied To About 9/11. You did a series of 31 interviews with various experts, and that's available online, and people can go to wewereliedtoaboutnineeleven.com. So, John, any last words for today's show?
The book is available for free. Anybody can go there and download it. If you feel the work is worthy, you can leave a donation, but it's not necessary to get the book. I did that because, you know, I didn't do these things all these years to keep it to myself. And I certainly didn't do it so that only the fortunate who can afford something could read it. I wanted to make it available for everyone.
Is there any place to hear the audio interviews?
They're available. There are two links in the book. One is to archives.org. All of the interviews are available there. Another is on my YouTube channel, which is Gold9472.
Gold9472, your YouTube channel. Thanks so much, John Gold, for joining us today. Again, I wanted to call the attention of our listeners to this great repository of information, this great archive of information with so many people who are all talking about very matter-of-fact issues surrounding 9/11 that we don't hear in the corporate media. And certainly, thanks to Philip Zelikow, are not part of the official historical record. So, John Gold, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I founded the program back in 2010. I am also executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers include Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook and Twitter. Special thanks to everyone at KPCA in Petaluma and KPFA in Berkeley, California, engineers especially, to get the show up and out each week. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Again, for show ideas or feedback, please contact us through our website at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, invisible lies, alibi skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Money as Debt. A radio program based on the soundtrack of the first film on banking that reached 2 million downloads and was praised by Catherine Austin Fitz, David Corton, and many more. Money as Debt by the Canadian Paul Grignon makes the case that only a small portion of our money is created by the government mint that prints or coins it. The vast majority of money is created by banks whenever a loan or mortgage is made. Banks, which are private institutions, are given enormous power to make and manage money, and it is well worth today to look at the monetary system. The film begins with a quote by President Woodrow Wilson as he attempted to regulate the banking system. He said in 1913, "Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." Woodrow Wilson, The New Freedom, 1913. Later in this program, you will hear another quote by Wilson, where he says what a terrible mistake it was for him to sign the Federal Reserve into being. Here are two more quotes to lead into the movie, Money as Debt. The process by which banks create money is so simple, the mind is repelled. John Kenneth Galbraith, economist. And permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. Mayor Amschel Rothschild, banker. And here now is Bob Bossen, narrator of Money as Debt.
Two great mysteries dominate our lives, love and money. What is love is a question that has been endlessly explored in stories, songs, books, movies, and television. But the same cannot be said about the question, what is money? It's not surprising that monetary theory hasn't inspired any blockbuster movies, but it was not even mentioned at the schools most of us attended. For most of us, the question, where does money come from, brings to mind a picture of the mint printing bills and stamping coins. Money, most of us believe, is created by the government. It's true, but only to a point. Those metal and paper symbols of value we usually think of as money are indeed produced by an agency of the federal government called the Mint. But the vast majority of money is not created by the Mint. It is created in huge amounts every day by private corporations known as banks. Most of us believe that banks lend out money that has been entrusted to them by depositors. Easy to picture, but not the truth. In fact, banks create the money they loan, not from the bank's own earnings, not from the money deposited, but directly from the borrower's promise to repay. The borrower's signature on the loan papers is an obligation to pay the bank the amount of the loan plus interest, or lose the house, the car, whatever asset was pledged as collateral. That's a big commitment from the borrower. What does the same signature require of the bank? The bank gets to conjure into existence the amount of the loan and just write it into the borrower's account. Sound far-fetched? Surely that can't be true. But it is. To demonstrate how this miracle of modern banking came about, consider this simple story, The Goldsmith's Tale. Once upon various times, pretty much anything was used as money. It just had to be portable, and enough people had to have faith that it could later be exchanged for things of real value, like food, clothing, and shelter. Shells, cocoa beans, pretty stones, even feathers have been used as money. Gold and silver were attractive, soft, and easy to work with, so some cultures became expert with these metals. Goldsmiths made trade much easier by casting coins, standardized units of these metals whose weight and purity was certified. Well, to protect his gold, the goldsmith needed a vault, and soon his fellow townsmen were knocking on his door, wanting to rent space to safeguard their own coins and valuables. Before long, the goldsmith was renting every shelf in the vault and earning a small income from his vault rental business. Years went by, and the goldsmith made an astute observation. Depositors rarely came in to remove their actual physical gold, and they never all came in at once. That was because the claim checks the goldsmith had written as receipts for the gold were being traded in the marketplace as if they were the gold itself. This paper money was far more convenient than heavy coins, and amounts could simply be written instead of laboriously counted one by one for each transaction. Meanwhile, the goldsmith had another business. He lent out his gold, charging interest. Well, as convenient claim check money came into acceptance, borrowers began asking for their loans in the form of these claim checks instead of the actual metal. As industry expanded, more and more people asked the goldsmith for loans. This gave the goldsmith an even better idea. He knew that very few of his depositors ever removed their actual gold, so the goldsmith figured he could easily get away with lending out claim checks against his depositors' gold in addition to his own. As long as the loans were repaid, his depositors would be none the wiser and no worse off. And the goldsmith, now more banker than artisan, would make a far greater profit than he could by lending only his own gold. For years, the goldsmith secretly enjoyed a good income from the interest earned on everybody else's deposits. Now a prominent lender, he grew steadily richer than his fellow townsmen, and he flaunted it. Suspicions grew that he was spending his depositors' money. His depositors got together and threatened withdrawal of their gold if the goldsmith didn't come clean about his newfound wealth. Contrary to what one might expect, this did not turn out to be a disaster for the goldsmith. Despite the duplicity inherent in his scheme, his idea did work. The depositors had not lost anything. Their gold was all safe in the goldsmith's vault. Well, rather than taking back their gold, the depositors demanded that the goldsmith, now their banker, cut them in by paying them a share of the interest. And that was the beginning of banking. The banker paid a low interest rate on deposits of other people's money that he then loaned out at a higher interest. The difference covered the bank's cost of operation and its profit. The logic of this system was simple, and it seemed like a reasonable way to satisfy the demand for credit. However, this is not the way banking works today. Our goldsmith banker was not content with the income remaining after sharing the interest earnings with his depositors, and the demand for credit was growing fast as Europeans spread out across the world. But his loans were limited by the amount of gold his depositors had in his vault. That's when he got an even bolder idea. Since no one but himself knew what was actually in his vaults, he could lend out claim checks on gold that wasn't even there. As long as all the claim check holders didn't come to the vault at the same time and demand real gold, how would anyone find out? This new scheme worked very well, and the banker became enormously wealthy on the interest paid on gold that did not exist. The idea that the banker would just create money out of nothing was too outrageous to believe, so for a long time the thought did not occur to people. But the power to just invent money went to the banker's head, as you can well imagine. In time, the magnitude of the banker's loans and his ostentatious wealth did trigger suspicions once again. Some borrowers started to demand real gold instead of paper representations. Rumors spread. Suddenly, several wealthy depositors showed up to remove their gold. The game was up. A sea of claim check holders flooded the street outside the closed doors of the bank. Alas, the banker did not have enough gold and silver to redeem all the paper he had put into their hands. This is called a run on the bank, and it is what every banker dreads. This phenomenon of a run on the bank ruined individual banks and, not surprisingly, damaged public confidence in all bankers. It would have been straightforward to outlaw the practice of creating money from nothing. But the large volumes of credit the bankers were offering had become essential to the success of European commercial expansion. So instead, the practice was legalized and regulated. Bankers agreed to abide by limits on the amount of fictional loan money that could be lent out. The limit would still be a number much larger than the actual value of gold and silver in the vault. Quite often the ratio was 9 fictional dollars to 1 actual dollar in gold. These regulations were enforced by surprise inspections. It was also arranged that, in the event of a run, central banks would support local banks with emergency infusions of gold. Only if there were runs on a lot of banks simultaneously would the banker's credit bubble burst and the system come crashing down. Over the years, the fractional reserve system and its integrated network of banks backed by a central bank has become the dominant money system of the world. At the same time, the fraction of gold backing the debt money has steadily shrunk to nothing. The basic nature of money has changed. In the past, a paper dollar was actually a receipt that could be redeemed for a fixed weight of gold or silver. In the present, a paper or digital dollar can only be redeemed for another paper or digital dollar. In the past, privately created bank credit existed only in the form of private banknotes, which people had the choice to refuse, just as we have the choice to refuse someone's private check today. In the present, privately created bank credit is legally convertible to government-issued fiat currency, the dollars, loonies, and pounds we habitually think of as money. Fiat currency is money created by government fiat or decree, and legal tender laws declare that citizens must accept this fiat money as payment for debt, or else the courts will not enforce the obligation. So now the question is, if governments and banks can both just create money, then how much money exists? In the past, the total amount of money in existence was limited to the actual physical quantities of whatever commodity was in use as money. For example, in order for new gold or silver money to be created, more gold or silver had to be found and dug out of the ground. In the present, money is literally created as debt. New money is created whenever anyone takes a loan from the bank. As a result, the total amount of money that can be created has only one real limit, the total level of debt. Governments place an additional statutory limit on the creation of new money by enforcing rules known as fractional reserve requirements. Essentially arbitrary, fractional reserve requirements vary from country to country and from time to time. In the past, it was common to require banks to have at least $1 worth of real gold in the vault to back $10 worth of debt money created. Today, reserve requirement ratios no longer apply to the ratio of new money to gold on deposit, but merely to the ratio of new debt money to existing debt money on deposit in the bank. Today, a bank's reserves consist of two things: the amount of government-issued cash or equivalent that the bank has deposited with a central bank, plus the amount of already existing debt money the bank has on deposit. To illustrate this in a simple way, let's imagine that a new bank has just started up and has no depositors yet. However, the bank's investors have made a reserve deposit of $1,111.12 of existing cash money at the central bank. The required reserve ratio is 9 to 1. Step 1. The doors open and the new bank welcomes its first loan customer. He needs $10,000 to buy a car. At the 9 to 1 reserve ratio, the new bank's reserve at the central bank, also known as high-powered money, allows it to legally conjure into existence 9 times that amount, or $10,000, on the basis of the borrower's pledge of debt. This $10,000 is not taken from anywhere. It's brand new money simply typed into the borrower's account as bank credit. The borrower then writes a check on that bank credit to buy the used car. Step 2. The seller then deposits this newly created $10,000 at her bank. Unlike the high-powered government money deposited at the central bank, this newly created credit money cannot be multiplied by the reserve ratio. Instead, it's divided by the reserve ratio. At a ratio of 9 to 1, a new loan of $9,000 can be created on the basis of the $10,000 deposit. Step 3. If that $9,000 is then deposited by a third party at the same bank that created it or at a different one, it becomes the legal basis for a third issue of bank credit, this time for the amount of $8,100.
like one of those Russian dolls where each layer contains a slightly smaller doll inside, each new deposit contains the potential for a slightly smaller loan in an infinitely decreasing series. Now, if the loan money created is not deposited at the bank, the process stops. That's the unpredictable part of the money creation mechanism. But more likely, at every step, the new money will be deposited at a bank, and the reserve ratio process can repeat itself over and over until almost $100,000 of brand new money has been created within the banking system. All of this new money has been created entirely from debt, and the whole process has been legally authorized by the initial reserve deposit of just $1,111.12, which is still sitting untouched at the central bank. What's more, under this ingenious system, the books of each bank in the chain must show that the bank has 10% more on deposit than it has out on loan. This gives banks a very real incentive to seek deposits in order to be able to make loans, supporting the general but misleading impression that loans come out of deposits. Now, unless all the successive loans are deposited at the same bank, it cannot be said that any one bank got to multiply its initial high-powered money reserve almost 90 times by issuing bank credit out of nothing. However, the banking system is a closed loop. Bank credit created at one bank becomes a deposit in another, and vice versa. In a theoretical world of perfectly equal exchanges, the ultimate effect would be exactly the same as if the whole process took place within one bank. That is, the bank's initial central bank reserve of a little over $1,100 allows it to ultimately collect interest on up to $100,000 the bank never had. If that sounds ridiculous, try this. In recent decades, as a result of steady lobbying by the banks, the requirements to make a reserve deposit at the nation's central bank have all but disappeared in some countries, and actual reserve ratios can be much higher than 9 to 1. For some types of accounts, 20 to 1 and 30 to 1 ratios are common. And even more recently, by using loan fees to raise the required reserve from the borrower, banks have now found a way to circumvent reserve requirement limitations entirely. So, while the rules are complex, the common sense reality is actually quite simple. Banks can create as much money as we can borrow. Despite the endlessly presented mint footage, government-created money typically accounts for less than 5% of the money in circulation. More than 95% of all money in existence today was created by someone signing a pledge of indebtedness to a bank. What's more, this bank credit money is being created and destroyed in huge amounts every day as new loans are made and old ones repaid.
I am afraid that the ordinary citizen will not like to be told that banks can and do create money, and they who control the credit of the nation direct the policy of governments and hold in the hollow of their hands the destiny of the people. Reginald McKenna, past chairman of the board, Midlands Bank of England.
Banks can only practice this money system with the active cooperation of government. First, governments pass legal tender laws to make us use the national fiat currency. Secondly, governments allow private bank credit to be paid out in this government currency. Thirdly, government courts enforce debts. And lastly, governments pass regulations to protect the money system's functionality and credibility with the public, while doing nothing to inform the public about where money really comes from. The simple truth is that when we sign on the dotted line for a so-called loan or mortgage, our signed pledge of payment, backed by the assets we pledge to forfeit should we fail to pay, is the only thing of real value involved in the transaction. To anyone who believes we will honor our pledge, that loan agreement or mortgage is now a portable, exchangeable, and saleable piece of paper. It's an IOU. It represents value and is therefore a form of money. This money the borrower exchanges for the bank's so-called loan. Now, a loan in the real world means that the lender must have something to lend. If you need a hammer, my loaning you a promise to provide a hammer I don't have won't be of much help. But in the artificial world of money, a bank's promise to pay money it doesn't have is allowed to be passed off as money, and we accept it as such.
Thus, our national circulating medium is now at the mercy of loan transactions of banks, which lend not money, but promises to supply money they do not possess. Irving Fisher, economist and author.
Once the borrower signs the pledge of debt, the bank then balances the transaction by creating, with a few keystrokes on a computer, a matching debt of the bank to the borrower. From the borrower's point of view, this becomes loan money in his or her account. And because the government allows this debt of the bank to the borrower to be converted to government fiat currency, everyone has to accept it as money. Again, the basic truth is very simple. Without the document the borrower signed, the banker would have nothing to lend. Have you ever wondered how everyone, governments, corporations, small businesses, families, can all be in debt at the same time and for such astronomical amounts? Have you ever questioned how there can be that much money out there to lend? Now you know, there isn't. Banks do not lend money. They simply create it from debt. And as debt is potentially unlimited, so is the supply of money. And, as it turns out, the opposite situation is also true. Isn't it astounding that despite the incredible wealth of resources, innovation, and productivity that surrounds us, almost all of us, from governments to companies to individuals, are heavily in debt to bankers? If only people would stop and think, how can that be? How can it be that the people who actually produce all the real wealth in the world are in debt to those who merely lend out the money that represents the wealth? Even more amazing is that once we realize that money really is debt, we realize that if there was no debt, there'd be no money. If this is news to you, you are not alone. Most people imagine that if all debts were paid off, the state of the economy would improve. It's certainly true on an individual level. Just as we have more money to spend when our loan payments are finished, we think that if everyone were out of debt, there would be more money to spend in general. But the truth is the exact opposite. There would be no money at all. There it is. We are totally dependent on continually renewed bank credit for there to be any money in existence. No loans, no money, which is what happened during the Great Depression. The money supply shrank drastically as the supply of loans dried up.
That was part one of the film soundtrack of Money as Debt by Paul Grignion. The narrator is Bob Bosson. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear about the reason why the debt created by banks must continue to grow. You can hear this program again by going to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, or by searching for the film Money as Debt on the Internet. The website of the film is moneyasdebt.net. The site is an excellent resource. You can find the script and all the quotes in the film with their sources. their reviews, responses to criticism, and praise from well-known and knowledgeable people such as Catherine Austin Fitz, Hazel Henderson, and David Corton. And you can support Paul Grignion by ordering the film on DVD. Since Money is Dead was made in 2006, Paul Grignion has posted two sequels, Money is Dead 2 and 3, and several short films. If you really rather have an audio copy of Money is Dead, download it from my website or call 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. And many thanks to Paul Grignion for making the soundtrack of his film available. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. New Bedford, Massachusetts, a seaport located in the southeast corner of Massachusetts at the base of Cape Cod, is the locale of our program. Early in New Bedford's history, a group of Quakers from Boston moved there. New Bedford soon became a safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans who had been able to escape bondage in the South. The stories of those who safely arrived in New Bedford on the Underground Railroad are presented at the 34-acre New Bedford National Historical Park in the Old Town section of New Bedford. This two-part series on the New Bedford Underground Railroad with National Park Ranger Mark Mello was recorded on September 2, 2016, with the sounds of wind and street traffic in the background. Part 1 begins with a historical perspective of the Underground Railroad and the way in which New Bedford, Massachusetts became a safe haven for former slaves.
So when we talk about the Underground Railroad, obviously we're not going underground today. We're not talking about a literal railroad. Basically, a loose connection of people, places, businesses, homes. We're going to attempt to get fugitive slaves from down south, ideally to the Canadian border. What a lot of people do not realize is not until you hit that Canadian border are you truly free. Well, there was no slavery in the north. Yes, but that did not mean that northerners were above sending you back into slavery. You have a percentage of people called abolitionists in America, people who believe that slavery is morally wrong, make up less than 1% of your population in the early 19th century. Most of your northerners at the time are indifferent towards the issue of slavery. Thus, the reason why you can travel just a couple miles out to either Dartmouth or Freetown, any of the surrounding towns, you'll still find houses where there are hidden rooms where they hid fugitive slaves. Why? Well, in the town of Freetown, there's one African-American man living there in the 19th century. You're going to stick out like a sore thumb if you're a fugitive slave. Thus, the reason why you need a hide and only travel at night. This city, though, was different. There's no hidden rooms, no secret passageways in the city. That is the remarkable thing about it. In this city, a slave could hide in plain sight. Why is that, you might be asking? Well, we'll talk a little bit about that at our first stop down on Water Street.
Across the street right here.
So standing on this very spot some 150 years ago, that is what you would have seen looking down there to the waterfront. Wow. Hundreds of thousands of barrels of whale oil lining the waterfront. But how do we get to this point? Well, our story starts with the lovely people who come over in the Mayflower in the 1620s, right? The pilgrims. In search of religious freedom, right? At least we're told in history they're looking for that religious freedom and that religious liberty. Problem. One of the ironic twists in history is that people in search of religious freedom were not going to guarantee it to others who came here. Other early groups to this area are the Baptists, people called Quakers or Friends. And basically, when these people get here, they're faced with an ultimatum from the Plymouth authorities and the Puritan authorities up in Boston. Convert or get out. The Quakers are going to be very important for our story today. The Quakers don't want to give up that religion that they have. They are Christians. They have a lot of interesting beliefs. Not a lot of people are familiar with them today. I always tell people, think of that guy in the Quaker oats, the oatmeal box. Typical Quaker garb. Very traditional people. Frugal when it comes to money. But they have some very important beliefs, which is very important for our story about the Underground Railroad. Amongst them is that Quakers believe that every man is his own minister. And every man has a right to interpret the Bible as he so chooses. You don't need a middleman between you and God. But with that, there's a very strong tenet in the Quaker community of equality. So right from the very beginning, you're not going to... The abolitionist population is very small, but a lot of those abolitionists are going to be Quakers. So big deal. Quakers are abolitionists. So what? What does that mean for New Bedford? Well, when they get here and Plymouth authorities tell them, convert or get out, they start to spread out. A lot of them go to a small island not too far away from here. I'm sure you've all heard of it, Nantucket. They settle there, and that is where Quakers are going to really start to build the whaling industry in the United States of America, is on that island of Nantucket. Others are going to go down to Providence, Rhode Island. Some of you may be familiar with the story of Roger Williams. He founds Providence on the idea of religious tolerance. But even Roger Williams doesn't like the Quakers. And he basically tells them, you know, you can stay here if you want, but I think you'd be better served moving to an island not too far away from here in what we would call Newport today. So a lot of Quakers settled there as well. But there's a problem for these spread out Quakers, especially the ones who stay on the mainland. War breaks out between the Native Americans and the colonists here in the 1670s. Spread out Quakers, easy pickings for Native American attacks. So what do? Congregate, right? Power in numbers. One of the first areas where they are going to congregate is right in this area. It will come to be known as Old Dartmouth. And one settlement will be right here on the shores of the Acushnet River where we now stand today. Well, why is that important? Well, one gentleman over in Nantucket is a whaling merchant. He's a Quaker. And he's sitting back and he's thinking, hey, this isn't a good place to be for this industry. A man by the name of Roach says, hey, there's got to be a better place to go. He's looking. He looks for Quaker settlements. He sees this little place called Old Dartmouth. He sees a little settlement on the shores of the Acushnet River. So the port here is protected from the ocean, not exposed to the Atlantic. We're on a river. It's a deep river, perfect for heavy laden down ships. Ample supplies of trees to build ships. Ample supply of farmland to supply these ships. Seems like a no-brainer, right? And that's what Roach thinks too. I'm going to go to modern New Bedford. And slowly more of his colleagues over there in Nantucket start to go, hey, he might have a point. And more are going to come here. And slowly it'll build and build to the point where in the 1850s, this is the richest city in the world. Because of the whaling industry. Why is that important for a fugitive slave? So what? Well, what did I say about Quaker beliefs? A lot of them are abolitionists. And who are most of the merchants here in the city? Quakers. Good rule of thumb in history. Where money lies, so too does the power. Guess who runs this city? Quakers. So right from the very beginning, the foundation of this city is built upon those Quaker ideas. And should a fugitive come to us in need of help, who are we to say no to him? So that is the atmosphere created right from the very beginning in the city. Another reason, though, why this becomes the perfect place for a fugitive slave to come. And the answer is right down there at the waterfront, the whaling industry. Come the 1800s, the time period in which we're talking about, Atlantic whales have been overhunted. They still exist, but they are tougher to find. So you think about it. When you go fishing, where do you go? A place where you know there's a lot of fish, or where you might not catch anything? You're going to go to where you know you can catch something. Same idea here. Where are all the whales? In the Pacific and the Indian Oceans. Problem though, right? We're here in New Bedford. We're not on the Pacific Ocean, are we? No, so how do we get there? We either have to travel around South America or around Africa. That voyage will take you 3 to 5 months, at least, assuming you hit good weather. No whale ship ever made can hold enough of supplies to last you 3 to 5 months. But if it takes you 3 to 5 months to get over there, how long is it going to take you to get back? The same amount of time, right? So it's almost a year in just voyaging to and from the fishing grounds. So in order to catch enough of whales to fill up your ship, you're going to need to stay there for 3 to 5 years. So you need to resupply your ship, not only with goods, but a lot of times, merchants, to try to get cheaper labor, would leave here with just enough of men to get the ship out of harbor and out to sea. And they travel across the Atlantic, following the Gulf Stream over to the Azores, islands off the coast of Portugal, Cape Verde, island off of Africa, the African continent itself, and there, with these island people who are experienced fishermen, we're going to take them on to our ship as crew members. Also, whaling stinks. It's not a pleasant way to make a living. And a lot of those Yankee farm boys who decide, oh, this is a great idea, get to a place like the Hawaiian Islands and realize Hawaii looks an awful lot better than that whale ship you're on. So they desert, they jump ship. We need the crew members, though, so where are you bringing them on? Hawaii, the Polynesian Islands, all those places. Whaling's also very dangerous. You're losing people along the way. So you're resupplying not only in goods, but with people. Guess where they all come back to? Right here. What happens to the diversity of this city, then? It explodes. Freetown in the 1800s, you only see one African-American man. You can walk these city streets in New Bedford in the 1800s and see almost every different race, ethnicity, culture, hear almost every different language, eat almost any kind of food, all on these city streets. Anybody a Moby Dick fan? There's usually one or two in the crowd. In that book, there is one chapter entitled The Street. You're standing on the street that Herman Melville wrote about in the book. And in that chapter, Melville goes as far as to say that there are cannibals who stand on the corners in New Bedford. Again, illustrating to us the diversity which exists in this city. You're a fugitive slave. Are you going to stick out? No. You can blend into the crowd here, and nobody will ever know the difference. Now, I bring you here for one final reason. And that is because the waterfront proved a major way of fugitive slaves getting into the city. And there's one story of a man by the name of Joseph Smith. Smith's a slave down in the Carolinas, works on a plantation, small plantation, only 30 to 40 slaves on it. One day, a buddy of his, who's also a slave, works in the city, comes back with news that there is a ship in the harbor destined for a city of New Bedford. And not much is known about that city, beside the fact that they claim to be welcoming of fugitive slaves. Smith makes the decision that, hey, I'm going to stow away, and I'm going to try to run away from slavery. Makes his way up the eastern seaboard on this lumber ship, stowed away below deck. Finds himself right down on State Pier, which is just on the other side of this row of buildings. Looks a little different today than it did back then, but it's still called State Pier. And he steps up out of the ship, and he looks up onto these very streets that we're now standing in. And what does he see? Thousands of people. Hundreds of barrels of oil lining the waterfront. Amongst those thousands of people up here, though, he sees people of all different colors. He sees carriages going up and down the streets. Maybe he sees a prim and proper Quaker elite merchant walking down the street. You want to talk about culture shock, ladies and gentlemen? This is a man who's only come in contact with less than 60 people in his entire life. And now he sees this. How would you feel? Can you imagine what he must have been going through? Make matters worse for him, someone from the crowd yells out, "A fugitive! A fugitive!" Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. I think Smith tells the story best from here, though. He later wrote, "I had never heard the word fugitive before. I was pretty scared out of my wits. But a slave had little to fear in a New Bedford crowd in the days of slavery. They all stood aside and let me pass." Many other cities all across the north, he would have been put right back on that ship and sent right back from where he came. There's a bounty on that man's head. There is an owner who is willing to pay an awful lot of money for him. Not in this city. In this city, they welcomed him. Between 1840 and 1860, there are approximately 1,000 free African Americans living in the city. We estimate that there was somewhere between 300 and 700 fugitives being harbored in this city, depending on which years you're looking at. You add that all up, it's a larger African American population than existed in Boston, Philadelphia, or New York City at the time. Basically, the largest African American population which existed anywhere in the United States outside of the South. Kind of remarkable when you think about it. But there's a problem, right? Think of yourself as a fugitive slave, and you are a woman. You run away, you find yourself in New Bedford. Well, great, I got away from my owner, I guess, but what am I going to do with myself? I have no family, I have no friends, I don't have a place to stay, I don't have a job. How am I going to survive? Well, for many of those women, the answer will be to work in the many boarding houses which would have lined this region. And at our next stop up on top of Johnny Cake Hill, we'll talk a little bit about their story.
We're visiting with National Park Ranger Mark Mello at the New Bedford National Historical Park in New Bedford, Massachusetts. He's sharing stories of New Bedford as a safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Diagonally, sort of kind of across the street from me, is the Siemens Bethel. Two Hebrew words, Beth and El. Beth meaning house or place, El meaning God. So house or place of God. Basically, it's a non-denominational place of worship. Now, why would you build a non-denominational place of worship in New Bedford? Well, think about it, my friends. You have a lot of young men coming back to the city with a lot of money in their pockets. What are they going to spend it on? Stuff they should not. Namely, alcohol, gambling, and women. Makes Quakers cringe. How could this be happening in our good city? We need to reform these young men. But how do we do it? We have men of all different kinds of backgrounds and cultures, right? I just mentioned that. All different kind of religious and moral backgrounds. How do we reach out to them no matter what their faith is? Well, we build a place that where your religion does not matter, but you can come and you can worship your God as you so choose. Whether you're a Jew, a Muslim, a Christian, a pagan, you can come and worship however you want without being judged. Right there on the first floor, if you were to walk through those doors, there's an area called the Salt Box. It's a makeshift school, rudimentary school. You only learn how to read and how to write. But think about that for a fugitive slave. And for many of these whalers who came to the city, never had learned never had any of them for the most part. Some of them had, some slave owners had taught them, but most of them had never learned how to read or how to write. I can't help but stand in this spot and look at that building, and it gives me chills every time I think about it. What that building must have meant to a fugitive slave on the Underground Railroad. Not only was it a place where you would not be judged based upon your religion, but it was a place where you could get an education. And what is more empowering than an education? Something special to those men. But back to the boarding house thing. The Mariner's Home right there is one of the original boarding houses which was here. Now, as I mentioned, whaling stinks. Not only figuratively, but literally. Whale oil reeks. You're bringing in a lot of it not too far away from here. So this whole region is going to smell awful. So where do you think all the rich folk go? They get out of this region. You can look down upon your assets. You don't have to smell them. So they head up into the city, up the hill, leaving behind many of the old original houses, like the Mariner's Home. That man who I said Roach, his home. His daughter donates it to the Port Society to be operated as a boarding house. Basically, a boarding house is like a European hostel. Same idea. It's not quite a hotel or a motel, but it's a place where you can sleep. You're going to have to share a room with strangers, but, you know, it's a place to sleep, place to eat, and it'll give you a nice little place to stay if you're a whaler here in the city. But what better place for a fugitive slave woman to work than in those boarding houses? Gives them a job, they have housing, 3 meals a day. What better setup could you ask for coming to this city? So a lot of them will find work in these boarding houses. And most of them will be relatively safe. Relatively. You weren't always safe. And one story is of a young girl named Mary. Mary worked on a boarding house right up here on top of Johnny Cake Hill, which no longer stands. She works there for a little while. That is until her former owner, a Mr. Wim from Baltimore, decides to go looking for her. He gets the deputy marshal down there in Baltimore, comes up here to New Bedford, because that's where he hears that Mary is, figures out which boarding house she's working in. Walks into that boarding house, finds Mary, confronts her, points at her, and says, "You are my girl. I'm taking you back." Put yourself in Mary's shoes. A woman who thinks she's finally achieved freedom. And now here, staring her in the face, is the one man who wants to bring her back into slavery. It's at this moment, though, that the other young women in the boarding house jump between Mary, Mr. Wim, and the deputy marshal, and quote-unquote get into a physical altercation with these two men. Two men are probably twice the size of these young women, and they are armed. And yet these women will get into this altercation long enough for Mary to sneak out the back door and never be heard from again in New Bedford. Or at least they think. Several years later, she'll write a letter to the Republican Standard, the paper here. Letter to the editor. And in it, she will write telling us of her story and thanking those women who remain nameless to history for helping her escape from her former owner. Now, that may be a great story to some of us, but here's where we have to have a reality check. By the standards of the laws of the 1800s, those women were criminals. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Think of the wording we're using here. Fugitive. When do we use that wording today? Someone who's evading the law. Technically, by the laws of the 1800s, Mary is the rightful property of Mr. Wim. And anybody who helps her to escape from her rightful property is basically aiding in theft. So by the standard of the law, they were criminals. Were they heroes? That is up to each one of you to decide individually. But one thing is for sure, they were heroes to at least one human being. That was the young girl named Mary. Now, that's what the women were doing. What about the men? What would a fugitive slave who's a man do when he got to the city? Well, I can guarantee you one thing. If there is one place on this planet that your owner will never find you, it's the middle of the Pacific Ocean. What better way to escape than to go away on a whaling voyage? And at our next stop, the Customs House, we'll talk a little bit about their story. I want to point your attention to the building right here. This is the Customs House. It's the oldest still operational customs house in the United States of America. So it's still doing the exact same thing it would have done back in the days of whaling. Certainly there are customs houses which are older. The one in Boston is. But this one is the oldest that is still in operation. This building was very important for a whaler, though, because you needed something here in order to get on one of these voyages. It's called a protection paper. I want you to think of a protection paper basically as the predecessor of a modern passport. Does the same thing. It says, I'm a U.S. citizen, and in foreign ports, I am protected by the U.S. government. So very important for a whaler as they go and journey around the world, right? Very important, though, too, for a fugitive slave. Is a slave considered a citizen of the United States of America? No. They're a resident. They live here. But they're not a citizen. No citizen could ever be held in slavery. So how do you get around it? Slaves aren't citizens. Fugitive slave gets their hand on one of these pieces of paper. They now have a legal document saying that they are what? A citizen. They now have legal proof that they can no longer be a slave. It's a powerful idea. Would it hold up in a court of law? Depends on who the judge and the jury are. But they do have legal proof now that they can no longer be a slave. But how does someone who's not a citizen get one of these? How do you go about that? Well, there's a couple different ways. One of my favorites is you find a wealthy Quaker merchant in the city, have him walk down here with you, walk through those very doors, walk into the customs official's office, and he walks up and he says something like this. I knew this man's mother from Philadelphia. Wink, wink. This man's mother was free. So what's the big deal? Well, we're dealing with Quakers here, right? When I say Quakers, New Bedford or Guilford Courthouse doesn't automatically pop to mind, right? What usually pops to mind? Pennsylvania. Philadelphia. So guess where these Quakers had business? Down there in Philadelphia. So they're constantly making that journey. Point two. If you were born to a free parent, you too would carry their freedom. Especially if it was your mother who was free. You would inherit that freedom. One visitor a couple weeks ago said, well, sort of kind of like an illegal immigrant having a baby here in this country today. Same idea. You would carry the freedom. You carry that citizenship in the country. Not necessarily upstanding stuff, though, right? That these Quaker merchants are doing, right? Did that Quaker merchant know that man's mother? Heck no. He had never met this guy until 2 hours ago. But he's going to do it to help this guy to get on one of his whale ships. Not a one-way street. Not just doing it out of the good of their heart. He's now that guy is going to go to work for that merchant. But it fulfills that very Quaker belief of let's help people help themselves. Funny, when you go down to the Whaling Museum archives, take a look at the African American protection papers. Guess where over 50% of them are from? Philadelphia. There's no way in heck they were all from Philadelphia. But it is proof of what was happening here in this building. There's another way to get a protection paper, though. And that is that if I can pass as a tall man of dark skin, dark complexion, dark eyes, dark curly hair, I can become that man as long as I have money to pay for said piece of paper. Get what I'm getting at here? There's a black market for protection papers. Illegal buying and selling of protection papers. So that is what's going on here. And that is how they're getting onto these whale ships, and that is how they're getting out to sea. And like I said, there's no better place to hide than the middle of the Pacific Ocean. He'll never go look in there, I can promise you that.
This was the first of our two-part series about the safe haven for formerly enslaved African Americans who made their way on the Underground Railroad to New Bedford, Massachusetts. Our guest is National Park Ranger Mark Mello, who works at the New Bedford National Historical Park. The books Mark Mello recommends are Fugitives Gibraltar, Escaping Slaves and Abolitionism in New Bedford, Massachusetts, by Catherine Grover, Whale Hunt by Nelson Cole Haley, and Leviathan by Philip Hoare, that's H-O-A-R-E. This program was recorded on September 2nd, 2016, in the Old Town section of New Bedford, Massachusetts. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.